Previously on the Salamonster Sounds Off.
Raw, Monday night, was not a good show. I turned the show off.
Turn it off. Like a light switch, just go click.
But no, I did. I turned the show off. I was so thoroughly disgusted. They would have Del Rio go over Ziggler to qualify for a spot in the Money in the Bank match. And I was just so pissed off, I just turned the show off.
Turn it off! Turn it off!
TNA, 2 weeks ago, I gave up on Impact halfway through the show. I just could not take it anymore, and I stopped watching. I had every intention of getting back to the show, though, this week. And I did. Boy, was that a mistake.
Turn it off.
This was terrible.
Like a light switch, just go click.
Done.
Turn it off.
Finish.
Turn it off.
See, I get angry with Raw, and I turn it off, and the fucking Shield breaks up. I get angry and turn off Impact, and I miss absolutely nothing. That's what I get for turning the show off.
Turn it off.
They're not fun.
Like a light switch, just go click.
Jesus Christ.
Turn it off.
Seriously, fuck this company.
Turn it off.
Fuck them.
Turn it.
Quite possibly the worst collection of tapings in the history of professional wrestling. The product sucks.
Turn it off.
Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. This is episode 332 of the Salamonster Sounds Off here for Sunday, June 15th, 2014. I am the Salamonster. Big thanks to Noah Mark for that masterpiece there you heard at the beginning of the podcast. You can use the official hashtag of the Sound Off, hashtag Salamonster, for any conversations on Twitter and Facebook that you want to carry on. That is the official hashtag for the show. You can support the podcast a few different ways. One of those ways is to sign up for an Audible trial, as many of you have done. So I thank you, the people who have signed up. It's a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service. You can sign up, free for 30 days, no obligation. You get one free audiobook. You can try it out, and if you like it, you can continue to use the service. If not, you get one free audiobook to keep. It's not a bad deal. So the custom URL for our show is audibletrial.com/Salamonster. Punch in that URL, and then you can browse around and do the 30-day trial and sign up, and it'll register under our link. That's one way, or you can make a PayPal donation on thesalamonster.com. The PayPal box is always there, day and night, whenever you feel the need to make a donation to the podcast. $10 or more, you'll get a wrestling nickname. We have a whole bunch of shout-outs here. I want to get through these right now. Paul Gaffney, thank you for your donation. Adam the Maniac Misaglia, the comic genius Hunter Palmer, who is in fact a real comic. Sean the Mangler Tanger, Stephen Godzilla Griffin, Rin the Chin Sechrist, Ronald the Sandman Silver, John Killswitch Kennett, Pistol Whip J.M. Potter, Trent Say My Name Sullivan, and Canadian Dynamite Cole Bloxham. Big thank you to everybody who donated a little or a lot to the podcast this week. It is very much appreciated, and again, you can do so on thesalamonster.com. Top story this week, Black Friday came a day early in WWE. On Thursday, WWE released 11 talents, including one referee. So I figure we'll go through the list here of each person who was let go, give some thoughts on them. The biggest cut is the one that was, it was kind of built up over the course of the day. I think the way it works is that they can't formally announce that you've been released until you've been notified and they've gotten you. It's almost like serving a subpoena to somebody. So I think JTG was either avoiding his phone or away from his phone or whatever the case was. But all day, as people were being cut left and right, people were making fun. Oh, how is JTG still employed? He, you know, survives the axe again. And then sure enough, the axe fell later in the afternoon when JTG was informed that, in fact, he too had been released. And so ends the employment of JTG, 7 years and 30 days under contract to WWE. Not bad. Not bad for a guy who did a whole lot of nothing. And I can't even remember the last time JTG had a match. I've said this before. I mean, you read house show reports. I don't know the last time this guy wrestled a match anywhere for WWE. Not in a dark match, at a house show, on the European tour, even an NXT taping, nothing. He's just been sitting at home collecting a paycheck, I guess. What more can be said? I mean, they weren't doing anything with the guy. You know, it was inevitable that he was going to be cut. How can we sit here and say, oh, that's such an unfair cut? Yeah, you could say they could have done more with him. Realistically, he was only going to get to a certain level. You know, I didn't see him above a certain level. They could have done more with him, but they didn't. And so, if you're not using the guy, get rid of him. If anything, I think he was under contract a lot longer than he should have been. Camacho. Camacho is the son of Haku, one of them anyway. I think his other son or sons wrestle over in Japan, I think. This was a little surprising in that he's been used a lot more often lately on NXT. He just got done his little feud with Adam Rose, which, in all honesty, bored me to tears. I can't really say that what they were doing with him was all that exciting, but I guess what was surprising about it was, again, he kind of did branch off on his own. He had size. He had a good look. He was in good shape. They just never had anything meaningful for the guy. And again, if they have nothing meaningful for him, then the best thing is probably just to get rid of him and cut the fat. And that's what they did with Camacho. And his fate may have been sealed once Hunico took over the Sin Cara character. You know, they had a good thing going with Hunico and Camacho. And at a time when they need more tag teams, they could have used them. But he's off doing the Sin Cara gimmick, and there was really nothing left for Camacho. Brodus Clay. Brodus Clay has been with WWE for a number of years. If you recall, he came in. First meaningful thing they did with him was pair him off with Alberto Del Rio and Ricardo Rodriguez. He was Alberto's heavy, his bodyguard. This goes back to 2011. And I liked him in that role. You know, that was probably the best role for him, was being this intimidating beast of a man who can watch your back. And it's not really all that different than what he was doing before he came to WWE. At one time, he was, I believe, Snoop Dogg's real-life bodyguard. So in a lot of ways, it was the perfect role for him. And then, if you recall, they were getting ready to debut him. They kind of branched him off on his own. They were going to debut him as this big monster, John Laurinaitis. I mean, there were promos that aired for him. Brodus Clay is coming. And I mean, he had already debuted on TV, but they were reintroducing him. And they reintroduced him as the Dancing Funkasaurus. And I was one of the few people at the time who actually liked the gimmick and wanted to give it a chance. I thought it had potential. I thought that it could get over and he could sell a lot of merchandise. And I said the way to handle it is you got to be very careful, because if he just becomes a comedy character and nothing more, then he's doomed. But if you handle it in a way where when he gets slapped or he gets punched and he really gets pissed off, he snaps, he's got a mean streak, and he just tears his opponent to shreds. And they never did that. They never went in that direction. They played it for straight comedy. He came out with the Funkadactyls. He danced. I remember at first when he was doing the gimmick, it may have happened a couple of times, but he had problems ripping off his ripaway pants, and it was kind of embarrassing. Eventually, they transitioned him into a team with Tenzai. They became the Dancing Fat Guys, and I guess that kind of worked for them for a while. Again, never did anything meaningful, never wrestled for the tag team titles or anything like that. They did the split. Tenzai became an announcer, and actually I think does a pretty good job at it, and I think he could even improve. So he's off doing his thing, doing the announcing, and there really was no role left for Brodus Clay. The most recent thing that he did was they brought him over to NXT to help put over Adrian Neville, kind of like what they're doing now with Tyson Kidd. They don't have any plans for these guys. They're just bringing them over so a guy like an Adrian Neville, who does have a lot of potential and who they hopefully do have plans for and see a future in, can get over, really at the expense of them. So it's not that they see any sort of value in a Tyson Kidd or a Brodus Clay. They serve a certain role, and that's what they brought him in to do. And to be perfectly honest with you, the matches with Adrian Neville, I think they had two of them. They really weren't very good. He just wasn't that good. I mean, he's been around for a number of years. He never really improved to the point where I would say, okay, you know what? He's really good in the ring. He's good for a guy of his size. He's good for a big guy. Maybe in small doses, maybe they could have booked him a little bit differently as this big monster who doesn't have long matches. But they would put him in there. He just wasn't that good. So what do you do with a guy like that? The Funkasaurus killed any chance of a serious run for the guy. I mean, that's it. He was the Funkasaurus for so long that it just killed any chance of people taking him seriously. And there was something there. I remember right after he did the heel turn, he broke away from Tenzai. Of all things, I think it was a Miz TV segment on Main Event. They didn't even air it on Raw. It was on Main Event on ION Television, but he had a really good promo. He came out in a suit. He had the bling around his neck and all that. And I remember he cut a really good promo. So they could have done something with him. But again, like a Camacho, he was never going to go above a certain level. It just wasn't going to happen. So he's already booked a trip to Japan for himself. Not to wrestle, although he is open to wrestling over there, he said. But there was a TMZ story that said he's heading over to Japan to protest dolphin hunting. been passionate about it ever since he saw a documentary about it called The Cove. And so he's heading over there. His main focus is bringing awareness to the cause of the Dolphins. So good for him. You know, I say thumbs up on that. I hope hope that works out for him. Evan Bourne. Evan Bourne is an interesting cut. Evan Bourne has been under contract to WWE for the last 2 years, although you would never know it because I think it's been about 2 years, maybe 2.5 years since we last saw him on television. He had a couple of wellness policy suspensions. I think the rumor was it was for synthetic marijuana, although I don't think that was ever officially announced. But anyway, he got popped twice under the wellness policy, so that second time I think was a 60-day suspension. Somewhere in there, he was in a really bad car accident, really fucked up his foot badly. I think he had surgery on it, maybe multiple times. Apparently, he's been healed up from that injury now for a while. I've read where he's been physically able to compete. He's been physically ready to come back for over a year, and they never brought him back. And I don't understand why. I don't know if they were just gun-shy, if they had it in their mind that they were going to wait and cut him, or if this was an impulse cut and they didn't have, you know, any long-term plans to do it. They just kind of looked over the roster and said, you know what, we're not doing anything with this guy, let's get rid of him. I don't know what their mentality was with this cut. All I know is he's been healed up for a while, and he's been doing a whole lot of nothing. And obviously he had something. He was an exciting guy in the ring. I remember seeing him way back when I was first going to Ring of Honor shows, and he was Matt Sydal, or Sydal, I should say, and he was doing his thing, and he was awesome. You know, for a guy his size flying around the ring like that, doing things, he reminds me of Adrian Neville. Adrian Neville is known for his high-flying wrestling, and he does the Red Arrow, which is a spectacular move. Well, what came before that? It was Evan Bourne doing his deal and doing the Shooting Star off the top rope, and for a while there, he was getting a little bit of a push. I remember when he was teaming up with John Cena in a main event on Raw once. And the fans were into him. He was really likable. He had the Air Boom team with Kofi Kingston for a while. I think they won the belts. So obviously they could have done something with him. And it's kind of surprising only because he's been under contract for so long doing nothing. A guy like him would be a great pickup for a TNA or a Ring of Honor. I'd love to see him go back to Ring of Honor. That seems to be the pattern of late. A lot of guys who came from Ring of Honor who have gone to mostly TNA have been ending up back in ROH, AJ Styles, Christopher Daniels, Frankie Kazarian, I think there's somebody else who I'm missing. I'd love to see him go back there and tangle with some of those guys, Adam Cole and guys like that. TNA, you know, people joke about TNA whenever they do these cuts. Oh, Dixie Carter's licking her chops. She can't wait to make, you know, Camacho the next TNA World Heavyweight Champion. Wouldn't shock me. But at the same time, there are one or two guys who, if I'm TNA, I look at and say, these guys can contribute. We should try bringing them in. I don't even know if they could afford to bring in any of these guys with what's going on over there. But of all the guys who were cut, if we're putting the comedy and the jokes aside, Evan Bourne is one of those people who I think could be a good pickup for the X Division in TNA, even though I'd probably prefer to see him go to ROH and just mix it up with those guys there. So I think he'll land on his feet. You know, he'll end up somewhere where he'll, I'm sure, have kick-ass matches and everything. And hopefully he's all healed up from his injuries and he can have a rebirth for himself. Yoshitatsu is another one who I hope can have something of a career rebirth because WWE completely just mishandled this guy from day one. You know, he came over from Japan. He was supposedly making good money over there, doing well in Japan. But he had a dream to work for WWE. So he came over here probably for less money, went to NXT and wanted to learn the WWE style in the American way. And I don't remember them ever really doing anything with him. Maybe at first he won some matches, but it was so long ago. He's been with the company for so many years. And what ended up happening with Yoshitatsu is what happens with most foreign, or I should say Asian, talent. And I'm not sure why that happens, but he fell into this thing where, you know, he doesn't know a lot of English, so, you know, let's laugh at him as he bows. And, you know, he came out to that wacky music, which I actually kind of liked, his theme music. But he had something. He was a good wrestler. And it's almost like they beat it out of him, because you watch him recently, he was on NXT a few times, you know, he didn't look overly impressive, the crowd was into him like crazy, they were chanting Yoshi's name, even on the most recent NXT, after we all found out he had been cut earlier that day, and again, this show was taped a few weeks ago, there were random Yoshitatsu chants in the middle of one of the matches on the card, he wasn't even on the show, so you know, people were into him. They wanted to see him do well. I think they liked him. He seems like a likable guy. If you ever followed him on Twitter, he would post you know, stuff like, good morning, everybody, hope everybody has a nice day. Like, he just comes off as such a nice guy. And the story from many months ago, which I think I mentioned here on the Sound Off, where there were reports that he had gone to management and said, listen, you know, I want to move to Texas. He found a community of Japanese folks in Texas, and he wanted to, you know, uproot himself and move there and be with other Japanese people. And he was told, no, we're not going to let you go. You have to be here. You have to be in Orlando. You have to do your training exercises and your drills. Like, he was a rookie. He's been wrestling for years. So the idea that this guy is asking you, please, can I move to this community in Texas? And, you know, I guess I'll travel to Orlando and go back and forth and do what I have to do. And they just shot him down and said, no, so important that you be here for these exercises so that you can learn, and we're not going to do anything with you, but we still want you here. You know, I remember reading that and being so angry for the guy. Like, why? Just let him move. Well, you know what? Now he's not under contract anymore. Maybe it's the best thing for him. Now he can move wherever he wants. He can move to Texas. He can go back to Japan. He can do whatever he wants. And I really hope he lands on his feet and he does well for himself, because I think he got dealt a bad hand by WWE. I really do. I don't think he was ever given any sort of serious chance. I'm not saying Yoshitatsu could have one day been world heavyweight champion, but for God's sakes, he could have been a solid mid-card guy for them. He could have held one of the mid-card titles. You know, he could have. And they never gave him a fair shake. So maybe this is the best thing for him. Curt Hawkins, one half of the former Edgeheads with Zack Ryder, who I'm sure was sweating bullets on Thursday. Curt Hawkins, we have not seen much of Curt Hawkins. We saw him, or I saw him, for the first time in a long time a few weeks ago on NXT. They brought him in. Again, I think it was to work with Adrian Neville, if I remember correctly. Maybe it was Sami Zayn. I'm pretty sure it was Neville. They brought him in, and they had a match, and it was good. You know, Hawkins is a good wrestler. Again, they just haven't done anything with him. And I heard that he opened up his own wrestling school recently, and he may not have cleared it with WWE, and so maybe there was some heat on him. I don't know how accurate that is, but I know he just opened a school. So it looks like he's already been planning for that next phase of his career, so I mean, I'm sure he'll be fine. Oksana, also cut by WWE, the sole diva cut this past week. You can probably go back to the knee drop on Naomi. Maybe that sealed her fate, although they took a while. I mean, that was a few months ago. They didn't fire her right away, but that was bad. Just what happened to Naomi, you could say it was a freak accident, but it was also, if you watch it, like, what was this woman thinking? You know, it was like Naomi was going for a sunset flip, and Oksana just drove her knee right into her eye socket. She could have gone blind from an injury like that. And it probably cost Naomi the Divas title. If the reports around that time are to be believed, she was in line for a match with AJ Lee and was probably going to win the championship. And it was going to be part of this big Total Divas storyline where Naomi goes to WrestleMania and she wins the title and she realizes her dream. Obviously, that didn't happen. Probably largely because of the injury from Oksana, which I'm sure was not intentional. But, you know, you can't be doing something like that. It was just completely reckless on her part. And again, they weren't doing anything with Oksana either. Oksana, there was nothing special about her. You know, she was another blonde diva on the roster. She wasn't exceptional in the ring. I never thought she was really that good. I never saw the appeal in Oksana. They had plenty of other divas who were more capable, who I wish they would do more with, and they kind of have started to do that with Alicia Fox. So this wasn't really surprising. Maybe it was surprising in that she's had more TV time of late. Otherwise, not really very surprising at all. If anything, probably should have happened a long time ago. Teddy Long, done with WWE, 15 years in the company. He started out as a referee, transitioned over to a manager, and then eventually into the general manager role. And he's pretty much toiled as the GM of mostly SmackDown, I think for Raw maybe for a time. He's gone back and forth for like the last 10 years doing the GM stuff. And you kind of get to that point where it's played out. It's like, what role is there for Teddy Long on TV? I don't see one. You know, because I am not a fan of the GM positions anyway. I wish they would just abolish them and do away with them, especially if you've got Triple H and Stephanie. You know, we're the authority, and they're flexing their muscle. They're making decisions. They're making matches. I don't see the point of having a GM on either show. If he's not going to be the GM, then what's he going to do? You know, is he going to manage somebody? I mean, who would he manage? And how effective would he really be in that role? Is he going to go back to being a referee? Probably not. You know, not at his age. I think he's in his mid-60s now. And apparently this was not a cut so much as his contract expired. So it was this mutual parting of the ways, and he is no longer with WWE. And don't be surprised if he gets inducted into the Hall of Fame next year. And that's not anything I've read. That's just me speculating. I think, you know, it didn't end on bad terms. You know, he had a long run with the company. He is a legend in the business. Go back before he went to WWE. He was doing stuff in WCW. And, you know, he's a name that goes back 20, 25 years, not just from his time in WWE. Certainly, you can make the argument deserving of a Hall of Fame induction for his body of work. Would not be at all surprised if he ends up in the Hall of Fame next year. Referee Mark Harris, the one sole referee who was cut this past Thursday. If you remember, he was the referee who was involved. It was a really, I don't know if it was botched, it was a really weird finish to a Natalya match on Raw last summer. So this goes back almost a year. And what happened was, everybody blamed the referee for it. I may have blamed the referee for it. It looked like it was his fault. I don't know if it was or not. But he took offense to this. He went on Twitter, this Twitter tirade, you know, shooting down this idea that it was his fault. And I guess the former referee for WWE, Jimmy Corderas, he may have made a comment that pissed off Mark Harris. And Mark Harris, I think, went off on Jimmy Corderas on Twitter. So supposedly he may have still had some heat for that incident last summer. I don't know that that's exactly what led to his being cut, because, again, that was almost a year ago. But then again, WWE has not had very many, if any, cuts unless somebody did something wrong. You know, if they violated some sort of company policy and they fired them. You know, it's been a long time since WWE had this, like, mass firing, this mass cutting of talent. So maybe they were just waiting. Maybe they were waiting for the next big mass cutting of talent to lump him in there with everybody else, and he's had heat this whole time. I don't know. But I wasn't surprised to hear of all the referees that he was the one who got cut. Not surprising at all. What was surprising to me was the cutting of 3MB, and in particular the cutting of Drew McIntyre. Now, Heath Slater is still under contract. He's still there. I know he's very well liked. Obviously, they trust him. I mean, if you remember, Heath Slater was the guy who almost exclusively worked with Bret Hart back in 2010 when they did the Nexus angle. It's like every time there was some sort of face-off on TV between the Nexus and Team WWE, and they did the big tag match at SummerSlam, Bret almost exclusively worked with Heath Slater. Slater took bumps for him. Heath is the one who worked with all those legends leading up to Raw 1000. They would trot out Vader 1 week and Psycho Sid another week. I think he even worked the match with Lita 1 week. So they trust him. He's well-liked. So I'm not surprised they kept him, but they let go of Jinder Mahal, which is not really that surprising. Drew McIntyre is the one that surprised me the most. I know it shouldn't, because they really haven't done anything with Drew in a long, long time. 3MB's been getting a lot more TV time of late. Poor Hornswoggle, it looks like, got his head shaved for no reason, by the way. So 3MB's been on TV almost weekly. You know, and they've been doing the angle with the Matadors and El Torito. So that caught me off guard that they would eliminate two-thirds of 3MB. Drew McIntyre, to me, is the most egregious cut in that it illustrates a guy who was completely wasted in his time with WWE. And I don't know what his situation is now, you know, because I don't know if he's on a work visa and how that might affect him if he has to go back home to Scotland, or if he can stay here and find employment in a TNA or an ROH. I don't know. That could be a dicey situation for him in terms of the work visa stuff, so I don't know how that works. But, you know, when Drew came in, let's go back a little bit here. Only in recent years was I aware of the work that he did in Florida. Before it became NXT, it was FCW, okay, Florida Championship Wrestling. Steve Kern was the booker and the head guy down there. And they had Sheamus was in developmental. Drew McIntyre was in developmental. They worked a lot of matches together. And I think the two of them were like best friends. They were always posting pictures together on Twitter. You know, kayfabe be damned, you'd see Sheamus and Drew McIntyre sharing a pint. So I'm sure it sucks for Sheamus that his friend got cut. But they worked together a lot in developmental. And again, Sheamus was the heel. Drew McIntyre was the babyface. And I remember seeing a match on YouTube, and they probably had multiple matches. But whatever the main title was down there, was like the FCW, what was it, that Jack Briscoe 15 title or something like that. Drew was the champion. And I'm watching this match, and I'm thinking, this is a damn good match. And this is a side of Drew McIntyre that we never really got to see on the main roster. He was really good. But that goes back years, when he was in developmental. So they finally bring him up, And they have him endorsed on television by no greater authority than Vince McMahon himself. Vince comes out and says, I proclaim this guy to be the chosen one. You know, it's like, here's Vince McMahon's stamp of approval. This guy's going places. And he won the Intercontinental title. He kind of gave off this young Triple H vibe. He was good. He was really good. You know, the accent was a little weird in terms of his cutting promos. I mean, I could understand what he was saying and all that, but it could be tough. You know, it could be tough for somebody with an accent to cut promos and for people to get into him, because that's just the way that we as fans are conditioned. That's why I think Adrian Neville may have a really tough time when he makes it up to the main roster. That's going to be, I think, for him, besides his size, that's going to be one of the biggest obstacles. But, you know, aside from that, McIntyre had it, man. I mean, he really could have been somebody big. And he seemed to have all the right people backing him. And then I know there were some issues with him and Taryn Terrell, the former Tiffany. Remember when Tiffany was the ECW GM? So they were married at the time, and I think they got caught. Because they got into a fight. I think Tiffany attacked him, and they were at a Playboy Mansion party. And again, you know, PG WWE, you don't want to get caught at a Playboy party. And TMZ picked it up, and I think that was a big embarrassment for him, and he had some heat for that. I can't believe, though, that was years ago, and the idea that he would still be carrying around some sort of heat or bad blood, and that's why they never seriously pushed him again after that. And again, he and Taryn Terrell got a divorce. They're not together anymore. There had to be another reason. There had to be something else. Maybe he had an ego and he walked around backstage and rubbed people the wrong way, had a chip on his shoulder. I don't know, but it's almost like a Dolph Ziggler situation where you have this guy who clearly has the talent, he has the tools, he can be something, maybe even a world champion one day, and for whatever reason, you just don't do anything with him. You know, if he did something so wrong and so heinous, then just fire him. You know, you should have gotten rid of him years ago, but they didn't. They kept him around. They just never pushed him. And I think that was a big mistake. I think of all the people who were cut, he jumped out at me as the one that made me the most, it kind of like made me shake my head more than any of the other cuts. The other cuts were not completely unexpected. This one was, in that I really thought at some point maybe they would try to do something with him. I think he was probably so badly damaged by the 3MB comedy stuff that he never was going to get above a certain level. But that's their fault. That's their fault for putting him in that position. He never should have been, you know, part of that act in the first place. They should have plugged somebody else in there and actually pushed the guy as a serious contender for the U.S. title, the Intercontinental title, and just see what you can do with him, and they never did that. That's not Drew's fault. That's on WWE, and I think that was a big mistake. Raw this past Monday night was live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. SEScoops.com broke the story earlier in the day about Daniel Bryan not being cleared to wrestle at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, and so therefore WWE forced to go with Plan B, which is to strip Bryan of the WWE Championship and put it up for grabs for the first time ever in a Money in the Bank ladder match, which will happen in Boston on June 29th. They really should have planned better for this. I mean, the idea that Bryan would have neck surgery and they really expected him to be back, you know, the very next month always sounded suspect to me on the outside looking in. I don't have the guy's medical records, but they got burned. I mean, plain and simple. I mean, I know they came up with Plan A and Plan B, but, you know, for example, how they got those titles from Bryan so they could hang them above the ring the way they did on Monday night was never addressed on this show. You know, once they came out at the beginning, Triple H and Stephanie, and they said, listen, you know, Bryan's not able to compete. They had a video from Dr. Maroon, who is a legit doctor. That was not an actor. He is the guy who I think oversees the WWE wellness program. He's the guy who Bruno Sammartino sings his praises, because many years ago he operated on Bruno's back and did a magnificent job. So we had Dr. Maroon on camera saying that Bryan is still hurt and whatever it is that he said. I don't remember exactly what the words were, but he won't be able to wrestle. And so they officially stripped him of the title. So ends his glorious WrestleMania reign. And there above the ring were the WWE belt and the World Heavyweight Championship belt. No explanation how they got them from Bryan, even though Bryan was on TV a week or two earlier up in Stephanie's face saying, I will not surrender my titles to you, because to do so would essentially render all of my hard work and all of the work that the fans did to help get me to this point, it would render it all null and void. So you are not getting my belts. Well, all of a sudden, the belts are hanging above the ring. So they didn't really plan this very well. It made Bryan wasn't there, so maybe they wanted to avoid him looking even worse by actually showing up and handing the belts over. They couldn't really do anything else with him if he's still hurt. They could do another backstage attack where Kane lays him out and they take the belts, I guess. But it still made Bryan look bad. A babyface essentially going back on his word, promising I'm not going to do this, and then it happens anyway. It just makes him look bad. So how they really expected him to come back so soon after neck surgery, I'm not sure. But he ain't going to be back in time. And I said last week, it's actually really troubling, these reports that are coming out about how his right arm is losing strength. It's not gaining strength. There's some sort of nerve issue. They sent him back to Dr. Maroon for some follow-up tests. I'm not sure what came from that. That could be really bad news, like long-term bad news for Daniel Bryan. And there's even a lot of worry now that he won't be back in time for SummerSlam. And that's a bigger problem, because the idea apparently had been for a Brock Lesnar-Daniel Bryan main event at SummerSlam, which is a match that I would love to see. It's a match that I advocated many months ago, and they didn't do it. So if they did it at SummerSlam, all good with me. I think it could be a hell of a match, and it's a fresh opponent for Brock to get in the ring with. But if that's not going to happen, what do you do with Brock Lesnar? You only have Brock Lesnar under contract for X number of pay-per-view matches each year. And SummerSlam is one of your bigger shows. You want to have a guy like Brock Lesnar on that show. But I don't want to see them shoehorn Brock into a match at the last minute. That doesn't make sense, just because they didn't have a plan B. So what do they do with Brock? There's been a lot of speculation that eventually they will build to a Brock Lesnar-Cesaro match. There'll be a split between Cesaro and Paul Heyman that hopefully, if they do it, they'll build it up slowly over time and they'll tell a good story with it. So do they speed up their plans and turn Cesaro now or in the next month or so, and then go immediately for a Cesaro-Brock match at SummerSlam? I mean, to me, that seems way too early for something like that. It'd be a big match for Cesaro, no doubt about that. I would rather they take their time with that, because I like the idea of them building to something where there's dissension between his two clients, and eventually Paul sides with his longtime guy, Brock Lesnar, and finally Cesaro could have that big babyface turn that he didn't get after WrestleMania that we all thought he was in line for. And maybe they build to a Brock-Cesaro match where it actually means something, as in for a championship, because that leads to what my idea would be. If Cesaro is not an option and they have a longer story, I would rather they just stick to their plans with that. The other option here, and I know a lot of people are going to roll their eyes at this, I like the idea of building, and this is assuming that Bryan is not able to go, and they know it far enough in advance, I like the idea of a Brock Lesnar-John Cena main event at SummerSlam. It's still, I know they did it once before. I mean, they did it more than once, but in recent years they've done it once. So it's not completely fresh in that way, although that was 2.5 years ago. And that match left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths, myself included. And I love that match. To me, that was one of the best matches of 2012. It's one of the best pay-per-view main events that WWE has ever done. Ever. Ever. In its existence. Because that match, it was so unique. It was so different. It was uncomfortable at points. We got blood, which does add something, because we don't get to see blood much these days. Both guys bled. Brock beat the piss out of him for most of the match. I know Cena stole the win in the end, and I didn't really like that so much. But it was an awesome match. It was different than any other main event I've seen in a WWE pay-per-view, maybe ever. So I have no doubt that the two of them can go in there, and they can have a really good match. And maybe the second match wouldn't be as brutal as the first one. Maybe it wouldn't have blood, and it wouldn't have a lot of the stuff that made it special the first time. But that's a big-time marquee match. Say what you want about John Cena hogging up main events. John Cena versus Brock Lesnar as the headline match at SummerSlam is a big-time marquee match. And the only way I would endorse this, and the only reason I like this, is, and again, people are going to roll their eyes at this, but it's all part of the plan, Cena wins the championship at Money in the Bank. Or maybe not at Money in the Bank. Maybe he wins it at Battleground. But sometime before SummerSlam, probably Money in the Bank would make sense, because I'm sure he's going to end up in that match. John Cena becomes WWE champion for a 15th time. Because it's going to happen at some point anyway. You may as well just embrace this idea. Okay? Because he will be champion again. He will one day surpass Ric Flair's 16 titles. It is inevitable. This will happen. Put the title on him now. Set up a Brock-John Cena main event for SummerSlam if Bryan can't go. And Brock, avenges his loss, and beats Cena and wins the championship at SummerSlam. That is the only way that I could endorse a John Cena title win at Money in the Bank. If that's the plan, if that's the idea, and if that's their reason, let's say if they do put the belt on Cena only for him to drop it 2 months later, I'm cool with it. I'm fine with that. Because as a backup plan, I think that's a big-time match, and I like the idea of putting the belt on Brock. Now, you have other problems with that if you do put the belt on Brock, because I don't think Brock should be beat until WrestleMania next year. I mean, this is the guy that ended the Undertaker streak. If you turn around and you beat the guy, you know, after that, you're out of your freaking mind. You've got to milk this for all it's worth. And it becomes difficult if you only have Brock for a few pay-per-views, and you put your title on him, and he's not around to do house shows and all that kind of stuff. Yes, it is problematic, but you know what? There's a way around it. Maybe you could talk Brock into doing some more dates, even if it's just TVs. You know, The Rock held the title for a couple of months last year. He didn't do house shows either, and they did just fine. This is a little bit different, I agree, because if you're going to keep Brock undefeated until WrestleMania, then you're talking about putting the belt on him for a hell of a lot longer than 2 months, okay? I get that, but here's a guy who brings legitimacy to that title. Here's a guy who brings mega heat to that title, the guy who broke the streak. And Heyman can go ahead and crow about how his client is the champion. I thought the Heyman-Punk pairing was great. Heyman and Brock is even better. So that's one man's opinion. If Brian can't go and they have to change their SummerSlam plans and they need a new opponent for Brock Lesnar, and I'm figuring it's going to end up being Roman Reigns and Triple H, and so that'll be the Roman Reigns match on that show. I like the idea of Cena and Brock, provided that Brock wins. Now, there's also the little matter of Seth Rollins, who, shockingly, has not been gifted a spot yet in that Money in the Bank match. Now, maybe that'll happen. Maybe they'll shove him in there. But right now, it looks like he's not going to be involved in that Money in the Bank match. And I would imagine that would cause problems with Triple H, given that Randy Orton's in there. So, if Seth Rollins is not involved in that Money in the Bank match, and they don't give him a run with the title, which I thought might have been the idea behind the heel turn, which they probably should do. I actually think that they should give him a chance to run with it, see how he does, get himself over as a heel. You know, he would be different. He'd be fresh in the role. I know the idea of putting the belt back on Cena is just makes you want to vomit, okay? I understand that, and I see why people would feel that way. I can't say that I disagree. It's just that my idea of doing it, there's a reason behind it, and it's a short-term deal. My goal would not be to put the belt back on Cena because, well, he's the fallback plan and we don't have anybody else. It's because I want to see Brock end up with that belt. But I would not be opposed to them giving Seth Rollins a shot with it and put the belt on him, but I'm just assuming he's not going to be in that Money in the Bank match. So if they're not doing that, if their plan is not to put the belt on Rollins, then I like the idea of Cena-Brock, personally. Alberto Del Rio already qualified for the Money in the Bank match with a win over Dolph Ziggler. I've already made my thoughts clear on that. The Authority inserted Randy Orton into the match without having to qualify. So our next qualifier here on the show was Sheamus against Bad News Barrett. Champion against champion. They had a real fun match, pay-per-view quality. As if the finish was ever in any doubt. You know, Sheamus took a beating for most of it, then just hit his kick out of nowhere, got the pin. He's like the Page of the male champions on the roster. You know, they are both pale, so I guess there is that connection. I like this match. I just wish they wouldn't waste champ versus champ matches so often on TV, like they're nothing. At this point in the show, we had Del Rio, Orton, and Sheamus in the Money in the Bank match so far. Boy, 2011 called. It wants its roster back. I mean, seriously, at least they've added Cesaro and Bray Wyatt since then. You figure they add Cena and maybe Kane to the match, and that's your Money in the Bank roster. It seems pretty heel-heavy to me if that's the case, if that's how it ends up. You know, give me one good reason why it would not have made more sense to have Dolph Ziggler in this thing over Del Rio. I'd love to hear it. Rybacksel beat Goldust and R-Truth. If Cody Rhodes is picking his brother's tag team partners, they need to keep him far away from their booking meetings. Yikes. He told Goldust later on that he's got a new partner in mind for him next week, and he's never met before. He's never met the guy before, but he is, I believe the word he used was, magnificent. He would be a magnificent partner. No idea who that could be. I figure Goldust keeps losing, and in the end, Cody probably comes to the realization that, you know what, it wasn't me who was the weak link in this team the whole time, it was you. And from there, they can probably feud and have a match at SummerSlam. The Usos beat Fandango and Damian Sandow, who was out there dressed in a flesh-colored bodysuit doing interpretive dances like a ballerina. And to his credit, he was awesome. He took it and he ran with it and he was great at it. People were laughing. They were chanting his name. Let's go Sandow. I say the chant that we should start is Free Sandow. That's the chant that I want to hear at these buildings. I want you to watch this segment and remember that it was a year ago. It was 1 year ago next month that Damian Sandow shoved Cody Rhodes off the top of that ladder to win the Money in the Bank briefcase, and then went on to wrestle John Cena for the world title. Think about that. Cesaro pinned RVD to qualify for the Money in the Bank ladder match. Not as good as Sheamus and Barrett, I like that more, but this was still a good match. There was a spot here where it was an awesome spot. RVD, he did a forward roll, kind of like what he does when he does Rolling Thunder. And coming out of it, Cesaro just propelled him into the air and nailed him with that uppercut of death. You know, that should have been the finish of the match, but he kicked out, ended up beating him with the neutralizer, which looked bad because I think RVD mistimed it, you know, but Cesaro was so freaky strong that he was able to save it and got him up for it anyway. I've been saying this for months. That uppercut should be his finish. He can hit that thing from anywhere on anybody, and the crowd reacts to it. It gets a reaction. That should be his finisher. We had the Shield out there, or what's left of the Shield anyway, Dean Ambrose and Roman Reigns. They made short work of 3MB, which is now 1MB, unfortunately. Dean Ambrose, I mean, what can I say? The guy is fantastic. You know, like I said on Twitter, I watched this and I thought to myself, the future is in good hands. I always knew that these three guys were going to be three of the guys that carried the company. I think Bray Wyatt is probably in that same conversation. But I watched this promo now that Ambrose is, and maybe one of the good things about the Shield split is that Ambrose has a better chance now to shine when it comes to promos, because we really have not seen a true Dean Ambrose promo since he's come to WWE until Monday night. It was awesome. He called Seth Rollins a cancer, said the Shield had a cancer in it that had to be cut out, said that he would end up rearranging Rollins' nose where his ear used to be because he would no longer be having an ear. Then he's going to rip out Seth's hair by the roots, shove it in his mouth where his teeth used to be. I love this. This was so great. Ambrose's stock went way up with this promo, and not just with me, but hopefully with the right people backstage. If he's this good as a babyface, imagine how awesome he'll be as a heel. Like a crazy heel, which I still think is the role for him in the long run. He could do the babyface thing now, that's fine. But this isn't even the tip, I think, of what this guy is capable of. I mean, he was great here. Roman Reigns was also good. He's not as polished as Ambrose. Like, his promo, it was good, but there were moments that were a little shaky. So he's not quite as polished. He'll get there in time. He just hasn't had very many chances to cut long promos. You know, he's always been the silent but deadly one in that group. Although I did like it all those times where he would slip into Playboy mode and flirt with Renee Young. But he still had a few good lines here. He told Randy Orton that when he got done with him, he wouldn't be the face of the company. He was going to be the ass of the company. He told Triple H they'd have their own Game of Thrones when they meet. And there's your SummerSlam match right there, by the way. So what followed this later on was Seth Rollins' turn. It was his turn to explain his actions. He had a sit-down interview in the ring with Michael Cole. He had new music, by the way, which sucks, and thankfully they're changing it, or so I read. You know, unless he's coming out and moshing and headbanging like he used to do when he was a babyface on NXT, it's not the kind of music that really fits his character right now. And of course, he was wearing a suit. And the only thing I can say about that is at least it was all black, which I guess kind of matches his old Shield attire, which he's still wearing, by the way. He's still wearing the Shield flak jacket. His explanation for turning on his brothers was that it was best for business, his business, that is. He created the Shield, and so he had every right to destroy it. He learned from Evolution that you need to evolve and adapt. He didn't sell out, he bought in. He bought into the evolution of Seth Rollins. He did not end a friendship or a brotherhood, in his view. He ended a business relationship. And at that point, he invited Reigns and Ambrose out to the ring, because earlier, Ambrose, and Roman Reigns said they were going to give Seth the chance to come out, talk, explain himself, then they were going to kick his ass. So Rollins said, "I'm here, boys. Whenever you're ready, come on down and kick my ass." So they came out. The lights went out. When they came back on, the Wyatt family was in the ring. And so a brawl broke out. They got their hands on Rollins, but he managed to escape. John Cena came down for the assist, helped out the Shield. And you knew exactly where this was going, because the main event had already been set. It was going to be Ambrose and Reigns in a handicap match against the Wyatts, unless they could find a partner. And I knew even before this segment who was going to be, and sure enough, it ended up being John Cena. So, for one night at least, John Cena joined the Shield to battle the Wyatts. I cannot adequately put into words how much I hate the idea of John Cena and the Shield being partners. Hopefully, just a one-week deal, and they don't do it ever again. As for the Rollins promo, I thought he did a good job with it. To me, the explanation was weak. His delivery was fine, but the explanation was weak. I get the whole business relationship stuff. That part at least makes some sense in that, you know, these guys, when they came in, they were mercenaries. Rollins, you know, he never forgot that part. And, you know, but this idea that Evolution taught him he had to adapt and evolve. How? They beat them twice. They vanquished Evolution. So from that, he learned that Evolution is the way to go. No mention of Triple H making him any promises, more money, a shot at the title, his own parking space, something, anything. I thought that was really weak. It just felt like your usual contrived wrestling explanation for why so-and-so turned on his partners. Only, to me, this made less sense than usual. Paige eked out yet another win over Alicia Fox, Scorpion Crosslock submission. They're now calling it the PTO, Paige Tap Out. Diva Stopwatch had this at just shy of 5 minutes, which is a lot longer than usual. The finish came after a miscommunication at ringside between Alicia and Oksana. Would not be a Divas title match without the champion getting her ass kicked for most of it, which is exactly what happened here. The best way I can describe what followed this match was that we witnessed a live rape on television. That's what it felt like. Alicia poured soda all over Oksana. She threw popcorn at her. She tried to shove popcorn down her throat. Not the first time Oksana has had something shoved down her throat, I'm sure. How else can you explain her having a job for as long as she did? Quite the send-off here for the Lithuanian. Main event was John Cena and the Shield over the Wyatts after Roman Reigns pinned Luke Harper with the spear. Good match. Exactly what you would expect out of the Shield and the Wyatts. John Cena was fine other than his usual spot calling, which was way louder than usual. I'm not sure if I'm the only one who picked up on that. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous how many years he's been doing this, and he's the top guy. And I can still call the guy's own spots before he even does them, because he's kind enough to share them all with all of us in advance. They went off the air with the babyfaces celebrating. Triple H and Seth Rollins were watching backstage on a monitor, plotting their next twist. It was a show. It's the best way I can describe Raw this week. It was a show. Speaking of shows, I caught the season finale of Legends House on Thursday night on the WWE Network. I have been watching Legends House every week. I haven't been reviewing it every week, but I have been watching. And the show now is over, although from what I've heard, there may be a reunion special that airs in the next week or two that was taped last year. That tells you right there how old this show is. The fact that they're having a reunion special that took place last year tells you how long this show's been in the can for. But now that it's over, I can comment on it. Overall, I have to say, I enjoyed it. I can see why no network wanted to pick it up. There really was nothing about the show that said, like, if I'm a network head, oh, I must have this show. This show is going to, you know, it's going to launch our network into the stratosphere. It was never going to do anything like that. But I thought, you know, I knew these guys from when I was a kid watching them on television. And a lot of it was contrived, as much of reality television is. But I can say that, you know, watching this show, it never even came off as contrived to me as the first three episodes I saw way back when of Total Divas, which completely turned me off that show. There were elements of this show that did shine through from their personalities, and it was nice. It was nice to kind of get that insight into them, and we really didn't get the deep stuff into these guys until the last two episodes of the show. If you go back to the week before, we learned that Jimmy Hart's daughter had passed away the year before, and he broke down crying. I mean, that's not the kind of stuff that you script. You know, it's not like his daughter is actually living. I wish his daughter was living, but apparently she's not. And his daughter passed away, and that's a really shitty thing. And to see the, you know, the hurt on his face, and I'd never seen Jimmy Hart break down crying on television like that. So as a fan, I'm watching this, and it hit me. You know, it hit me hard. And then we had this week's episode, which started out, it was all peppy and happy, and, you know, Ashley came into the house, and she's told them what they're going to be doing for their final challenge, or whatever you want to call it, since things were winding down. And so I guess to celebrate their leaving the Legends house, they were going to go out for one last big dinner. They went to a steakhouse, and it started out all happy. They were sharing stories of their, I think, favorite moments in the business and stuff. And then it took a really weird turn, and it turned into something where each guy had to reveal like a deep, dark secret or something about themselves that the other people didn't know. And Tony Atlas told the story about how in 1989 he was homeless. He was sleeping on the street or on a park bench or something, and it was 22 below zero, and whatever the temperature was, it was cold. And he would have died out there, but this woman came and found him, and she basically took him home with her and threw him in a bathtub so he can warm up. And that woman turned out to be his wife, and they've been married ever since. And you got the sense from Tony Atlas at different points during the show that he really does love his wife, which is cool. You know, it's a cool thing to love your wife, right? Nothing wrong with that. And that was his story. Hillbilly Jim, who comes off as the nicest freaking guy on this show. It's almost impossible for me to fathom that somebody in the wrestling business can be this nice. I can't find one bad word to say about this guy. He comes off as so cool. And his story was that, you know, he was raised by a single mother in the projects, I guess, down there in Kentucky or wherever he was raised. And when he made it big in wrestling, he bought his mother a house, I think, in a car, before he even bought that for himself, which I thought was exactly the kind of thing I would expect Hillbilly Jim to do for his mom. Jim Duggan, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, had a really sad story that I did not know. I think he talks about it in his book. I really need to get around to reading his book, but I think he talks about it in there. But it's a story on the show. He said, I've never shared this with anybody before except Roddy Piper, because the two of them are good friends. And he talked about, you know, I guess maybe back when he was in Mid-South, or maybe it was just when he came over to WWE, would have been in the mid-80s. His first wife, I think they had just bought a house, and they were riding down the road. They were in a car accident. Somebody hit them. And he just remembers waking up from the accident, and he looked down, and I think he saw his wife's sneakers, but couldn't see her. People were crowding around the car and like, oh, you know, what's going on here? And he got out, and, you know, that's when he realized that his wife was dead or dying, and maybe she died on the way to the hospital, but she passed away. And again, to see Jim Duggan, who's a tough guy, you know, and he has this tough exterior, and I've never seen him cry on television before, and here he is on this show breaking down crying for everybody. I mean, it's sad, you know. It was sad to watch that. Mean Gene talked about having being born with a kidney disease and many years ago needing a kidney transplant, which I knew. I was always under the impression that it was one of his sons who had donated their kidney to him, but according to him, it was his wife. And when Mean Gene told the story, again, first time I've ever seen Gene Okerlund break down just absolutely in tears, crying. I know this sounds like the most depressing show in the world, but it actually was really cool, I guess, to see them open up like this. Very emotional. Trying to think, am I missing anybody here? Piper didn't really have anything to share. I can only imagine if Roddy Piper really wanted to go deep into his deepest, darkest stories and secrets. So I think for the sake of our sanity, he kept it relatively mild and said, oh, well, I have like four great-grandchildren. And that was his story. Jimmy Hart again talked about his daughter passing away. Howard Finkel talked about being bullied, badly bullied physically and verbally as a kid, and then making it big in the wrestling business as a ring announcer and proving all of them wrong, and he became an effing legend. And, you know, I felt happy for Howard watching that, because you could tell he takes a lot of pride in that. And then they got to Pat Patterson, and that was part of the advertising. They were building this up as a big reveal, and we all pretty much figured, okay, they're going to have him admit that he's gay, and they're all going to act surprised, and they're going to insult our intelligence, because Patterson being gay he's never come out, I guess, publicly and admitted anything, but it's been an open secret in wrestling for like 30 or 40 years. And so it's time for his big moment, and he's getting all emotional and weepy, and he's crying, and he reveals that he started out with no money. He traveled to this country, worked for Vince McMahon in the office. Everything that he's done, everything that he's been through, he did it as a gay man. And this actually was not anywhere near as bad as I thought it would be, because they didn't play it off like everybody was surprised. I mean, they showed some like shocked facial expressions kind of on some of the guys, but they didn't play it up that way at all. They played it up as, like, Mean Gene, for example. They did these cut-ins where they're interviewing guys, and Mean Gene said, you know, Pat, I'm so happy for Pat that he can finally get this weight off his shoulders. I met his former partner many years ago. He was a wonderful man. So they didn't insult our intelligence. We all pretty much were left with the impression that they knew. But for Patterson, this was a big deal because he's never actually come right out and said it, let alone in front of a camera. You know, and he got very emotional. He said, you know, the guy that he was with, they were together for like 40 years. And I remember hearing about that his partner died of a heart attack like 10 years ago. It was a while ago. And so he talked about that. He started crying. And this whole scene was easily the most emotional thing on any episode of Legends House. And it was one of the most emotional things probably on any hour that WWE has ever produced. It was almost like a therapy session for these guys. And I learned some things that I didn't know before, especially on the Duggan stuff. I had no idea that happened to his first wife. Really sad, really emotional. But yet, when you came away from this episode, it didn't end on a low note, because they had one more challenge where they had to perform a song in front of a group of people. Patterson did what he does best, which is he did karaoke for the song My Way. He's notorious after shows for doing that for many years. I'm sure he's probably sung that song 10,000 times. He knocked it out of the park. He was awesome. Patterson was great here. And then they did their goodbyes at the house, and the show ended. So, in my opinion, well worth going out of your way. If you've never watched Legends House and you kind of dismissed it, or you watched a little bit of the first episode and never went back, if you've got a subscription to the network, go and watch the final episode. I think it's well worth it. It's emotional. There's some fun, happy moments there. You'll learn some things about these guys that I guarantee you never knew before. And I hope they do a second season with a new cast. I figure that they'll probably bring in all new guys. Supposedly they're going to move ahead with it. I think Legends House is one of the most popular shows on the network. So they're probably going to do a season two. I hope they do. I hope they do, because of all the reality TV shows I've seen, and a lot of them are just, they offend me in how blatantly fake and phony they are, or just how stupid they are. The people on those shows are so freaking unlikable. This was a reality show that I watched where I think I could do a pretty good job of parsing the bullshit from the real stuff. And I actually genuinely liked some of the guys on this show, and I knew them from when I was a kid watching them on TV, and some of the stuff they did was actually legitimately funny. If you missed it, watch it. You'll enjoy it. NXT this week was a fantastic episode. Best wrestling show on Thursday nights. Another great episode. I do want to mention one thing, though. In my review last week, I talked about the graphic for the Adrian Neville-Justin Gabriel match. It was, you know, a production botch, whatever. The graphic said that it was a title match. It was no DQ. It turned out neither one of those things was true. And I made a crack about how, well, you know, do they have a developmental production team as well? Well, turns out they kind of do. I heard from somebody who works at Full Sail, and I heard from a few other people who emailed me as well, that they actually do, it might be part of their deal with Full Sail, they have students who are working in production, hope to one day work in production, who, I don't know if they kind of take the show as their own, or they just handle parts of it, but they do contribute to the production of the show. So, my apologies for that, although, still, I don't know how a graphic like that ends up on TV, but this week's episode was a fantastic show. I loved it. Opened with Paige, Emma, and Bayley against Charlotte, Summer, and Sasha, the BFFs, back together. Bayley wins the match for her team with a schoolgirl on Charlotte. Paige, I don't think, wrestled one time in this match. Emma took most of it. Emma opened the match. She was in there getting her ass kicked. Finally, she got the hot tag to Bayley. I like that in that they could have very easily given Paige the hot tag. She's the NXT former women's champion, current Divas champion. She's the biggest star of anybody in that match right now. So she could have run wild and looked like the Paige of old, but they gave the hot tag to Bayley. Bayley is usually, she's lovable and affable, and she comes out, and she's a great wrestler, but she gets her butt kicked. She doesn't really have much of a mean streak. Well, this is the first time we really got to see her kind of play the role of House of Fire coming off a hot tag here. She came in, she cleaned house again. She got the win with the schoolgirl in the end, that lovely roll-up finish that we all love so much. But this was a good match, even though Paige never actually tagged in and got involved. We had footage from earlier in the week of JBL signing a new superstar to an NXT contract, calls himself Mr. NXT. Man in a white mask. And the man in the white mask said that we better believe that he means business. It was very obvious, comically obvious, in fact, who Mr. NXT was. We had another segment with the BFFs arguing with each other backstage, clearly continuing to build heat between Charlotte and Summer for the eventual split. All of a sudden, Alexa Bliss comes in to retrieve her bags from her locker, and this upsets Sasha Banks. They go back and forth, they jaw jack, and Alexa challenges her to a match at a later date. Summer had a great line here, though. They're looking, because Alexa Bliss is like 2 feet tall. I exaggerate. She actually is maybe a legit 5 feet, maybe not even. She's very, very short. And Summer looks at her and just goes, how old is she? Which is a valid question, because she looks like she could easily pass for 15 years old. I mean, she makes AJ Lee look like a 40-year-old. So I guess we'll be getting that match at some point in the near future. CJ Parker, another CJ Parker sighting. He was carrying another sign with messages about recycling and the environment and the crowd. Fine by me. This was quick and painless, the way I like my CJ Parker segments. Colin Cassidy, still without Enzo Amore. He needs Enzo back in the worst way. Enzo has been sorely missed. He beat Sylvester Lefort, came out with his buddy Marcus Louis. And at a time when they need more tag teams, you know, they're building up that team of, what was it, Jason Jordan and Ty Dillinger. We saw them last week beat the team of Ghouljar and whoever his partner was. And, you know, Lefort and Marcus Louis could be another solid addition to the tag team division if that's the way they want to go with it. But this was a singles match. Cassidy won. We haven't seen him win too many singles matches lately, so this was nice. We had a segment backstage with Natty's husband and Natalya. That's what the crowd's calling Tyson Kidd now, Natty's husband. And he tried to impress upon her how very important this match was to him. And even though you're in my corner, I need you to know this is not about you. This is about the title. And Natalya's telling him, look, I understand that. You know, I could stay back here if you want me to. He's like, no, I want you out there with me. I just want you to know this is about the title, nothing else. We had Aiden English in a backstage segment. He was singing to himself when all of a sudden this newcomer walks up to him. And this is Simon Gotch is the name that they've given him. I guess a combination of Frank Gotch or Carl Gotch or whichever Gotch, take your pick. And I think Dean Malenko's real name is Simon, Dean Simon. So I think it's some hybrid mix of the two, but his gimmick is this old-fashioned strongman. He's got a, you know, the mustache, kind of like a lot of guys back in the day did, the Charlie Chaplin days. He never spoke. He never said a word. The announcers, they never even named him, but that's who it was, Simon Gotch. He lifted up a piece of the set backstage, showing his great strength, and he walked off. Never spoke a word. So they're obviously going to be a tag team. And again, I think it's a good idea. I think they need more tag teams. Aiden English, you know, I soured on him a long time ago. He bores me to tears right now. So any way they could get him going again, it's probably the right move to make. Sami Zayn and Mr. NXT in one of the greatest segments in the history of not only NXT, but probably WWE. It won't make anybody's top 10 list or anything like that all time, but this was phenomenal. They had a good match, but it wasn't about the match. Let's be honest, it was about the post-match. Mr. NXT comes out to the Bo Dallas entrance. He does the Tim Tebow pose, and he goes, you know, he does his whole yeah, baby thing, and everything that you would expect Bo Dallas to do, but he's not Bo Dallas, he's Mr. NXT. So they have a match. At some point, Sami Zayn manages to rip the mask off him, and he reveals that it is, in fact, Bo Dallas. And the funny thing about that is when he does that, Bo, it's almost like he covered up, like somebody had ripped his underwear off and he was standing there naked. It was just his mask, but he covered up like he was now nude. And Sami gave him the haluva kick in the corner. 1-2-3, gets the win. So now poor Bo Dallas is in the ring, and Sami sends campus security down to escort him from the building. And that's when the insanity started, because Bo Dallas was not going to go quietly. So as the security entered the ring and tried to grab him, he ran away. A chase ensued around the ring. I think they even made a Keystone Cops reference on commentary, which is exactly what this was. Eventually they caught him. He would not relinquish his hold on that rope. He would not relinquish his hold on the ring post. He said, "Nope, you can't take me. I'm not going." Again, it was almost like somebody had whispered in his ear that you've now been signed by TNA and we're going to take you over. It's, again, only a 13-minute drive over to the Impact Zone, and he just would have none of it. He was not going anywhere. So eventually they pried his fingers off. They carried him through the crowd. He was trying to tell anybody who would listen that they touched my bum. He said one of the security guards touched his bum. It sounds illegal to me. So they carried him to a golf cart. Okay, these guys are riding in style on this campus at Full Sail. They take him into a golf cart, and Bo is fighting him. He's saying, "I need a drink of water. I need a drink of water." He goes, "I'll go quietly. I promise, I'll go quietly." And I think they may have let him go, and then, of course, he bolted again. He ran out of the building, and it was comical because you're watching this, and they're on a college campus here. And it makes you wonder how many students on that campus are smartened up to what's going on here, because I'm sure some of them have no idea about WWE or wrestling or NXT or anything like that. And all of a sudden, this guy in his white trunks and his white boots, okay, with his gut kind of shaking, okay, and bouncing up and down, runs out of the building, and it's broad daylight outside. There were two female students who looked like they were scared out of their wits. They had no idea what was going on. And they're chasing him, and it was weird because he ran out of the building, but then he kind of ran in a circle. It's almost like he did a U-turn, tried to run back into the building. They caught him again. They subdued him. For those of you who may have missed it, they actually posted bonus footage on their YouTube channel. There was another 2.5 minutes to this of them driving him through the campus in this golf cart and him struggling and fighting. And then, you know, daylight turned to dawn. It turned to night. He managed to elude capture, and they found him, so now it's pitch black outside. It looked like an episode of Cops. I think I saw somebody make that comment. That's exactly what it looked like. The cameraman's running. The camera's going all over the place. It was awesome. My words can't even do this justice. I'm trying, but you really just owe it to yourself to find this on YouTube or on the network and just watch it for yourself. My first thought when I watched this was it reminded me of the Mountie at SummerSlam 1991, the Mountie had lost a jailhouse match at Madison Square Garden to the Big Boss Man. And as per the stipulations of the match, whoever lost would have to spend a night in the New York City jail system. So Mountie lost the match. The cops came. They cuffed him. They took him off. He fought. Everything he could possibly do to fight this. They tried to stick him in the paddy wagon. He almost kicked the window out. They drove him down to the police station. The whole time he's yelling, he's screaming, you can't do this to me. I'm the Mountie. You can't do. I'm an officer of the law. And they take him in. They want to take his picture. He goes, "You're not taking my picture." And they say, "We're going to take your fingerprints." He goes, "You're not taking my fingerprints." He goes, "You want the finger? Here's the finger." And he flipped him the bird. And this was in 91, and they didn't even blur it out. There it is. He flipped him the bird. And they put him in the jail cell. And, of course, there's a guy wearing leather in there, and he starts freaking out. That's one of my all-time favorite series of skits in WWE, was when the Mountie was hauled off to the Slammer. This reminded me of that. Bo Dallas reminded me of the Mountie in 1991, and I say that as a compliment. I say that in the nicest, best possible way. This was awesome. This was phenomenal. This was a good week for Bo Dallas. He was on SmackDown. He had a match with R-Truth. Everyone was raving. You got to see this entrance, because I wasn't going to watch SmackDown this week. I was going to try to watch the Dean Ambrose Bray Wyatt match. I still haven't seen that yet. I heard it was good, but I just had to see this R-Truth entrance with Bo Dallas that people were raving about, and it's comical because R-Truth comes out, he's singing his song, he's doing his rap, and the camera keeps panning back to Bo Dallas in the ring, his opponent, who's got this big smile on his face, and he's dancing. He's got some moves. He's dancing to the music. It was awesome. Bo Dallas is so freaking awesome in this role. This is comedy in wrestling done right. And I don't know how long he can do this for. At some point, you know, if you want to take him more seriously, how far can the guy go? He can go as far as they want him to go. I think at some point this stuff may get old, but it ain't anywhere close to being old right now. This guy is getting over. He's doing it on his own. And I think it's just hilarious. This was freaking awesome. I love this. Then, as if that wasn't great enough, we had a main event of Adrian Neville and Tyson Kidd rematch from NXT TakeOver. They had a really good match at TakeOver. I didn't think it was as good as I expected it to be. Maybe my expectations were too high. I thought Sami Zayn and Tyler Breeze on that show was awesome. I thought the women, Charlotte and Natalya, stole the show. They had one of the best Divas matches I've ever seen in terms of the match and the emotion and the story and everything else. So I think Neville and Kidd kind of got overshadowed there. But here, I thought they had a better match than they did at TakeOver. This was a really good match. It started a little slow, but it got really good in the end. Like, the last 3 or 4 minutes of this match were awesome. And Kidd was trying everything he could do to beat Neville. Neville kept kicking out. Kidd executed the best blockbuster that he's done yet off the top rope. Neville sold it. I mean, it looked like his neck broke for real. He kicked out of that. Kidd went back up to the top. Springboard elbow drop. Tried again. Neville kicked out. Could not put this man down. And I think he went outside to grab a chair. Did he go outside to grab a chair? Or am I making that up? I could have sworn he went outside to grab a chair. He was very desperate. Anyway, it backfired on him. Neville hit the red arrow, got the pin, retains the championship. And the final scene is a dejected Tyson Kidd in the ring with Natalya consoling him and putting her arm around him. And I don't know if the inevitable here is a split between the two of them. I don't know if that's the direction they're going in, or if Kidd is, if Natalya's going to turn heel and they're going to be a heel duo. I don't know what the end game here is, but they're certainly building to something. They're building to a turn, I would think, between the two of them, which hopefully art does not imitate life, being that they just got married. But this was awesome. This was an awesome show. You had a great main event. You had the awesomeness of Bo Dallas, who also had a good match with Sami Zayn. I thought the women's opener was actually pretty good. Some of the backstage segments, you know, they advanced storylines. I mean, the Mr. NXT backstage thing was awesome. The Simon Gotch, Aiden English one is good in that it introduced a new character and it probably sets up a new tag team, so that's fine. They set up the Alexa Bliss, Sasha Banks match, I assume, for this week's NXT. I guess we'll find out. And again, in an hour, it was over. This is not a show that overstays its welcome. When Impact is horrible, it is a long 2 hours. When Raw is bad, it is an even longer 3 hours. It's almost an excruciating 3 hours sometimes to sit through. I never get that feeling with NXT. You know, it does have the benefit of being a shorter show. If NXT were 2 hours every week, it might suffer a little bit more, but that's not what this show is. It's an hour that they give you some good wrestling, they advance some new storylines, they introduce some new characters. That's how wrestling should be. This was a fun hour of television. I love this show. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. TNA has its Slammiversary pay-per-view tonight from Dallas, Texas. The main event has undergone a bit of a change, given that MVP has a knee injury that he will not be able to recover from, obviously, in time for tonight's pay-per-view. He is out with a torn meniscus in his knee. So what would have been an MVP Eric Young championship match inside a steel cage has now turned into Eric Young defending the TNA title in a three-way against the winner of the Samoa Joe-Bobby Lashley match and the winner of the Kenny King Austin Aries match. As far as who wins here, and this may be more of a pick on my part of who I'd like to see win rather than who might actually win, I would go with Samoa Joe. I think the first step here, if they want to try to rehab things and rehab the title, which is really taking a backseat. Eric Young seems like a really nice guy, and I know he's trying. He's had some good matches. It's hard to take things seriously, though, with him as the world champion. Bully Ray, it's almost like, you know, Eric Young is having one of those old Chris Jericho title reigns or a Daniel Bryan title reign or a Chris Sabin title reign when he was the TNA champion, in that he's not necessarily the feature performer. I would actually put Bully Ray above him right now just in terms of how he's positioned on that show. Bully Ray is a guy who's way over with the fans. People are, you know, desperate to see him, you know, get to Dixie and, you know, beat up EC3 and all that kind of stuff. He's the one traveling to Nashville and terrorizing the boss and all this kind of stuff. And Eric Young is almost in the background. You know, he's almost a background player in some ways. I think the first step is to get the belt back on a credible champion. That will not turn around all their fortunes, but it'll be a step in the right direction. Samoa Joe has been overlooked in that role, I think, for far too long. They need to get the belt back on him. That's the first step. He's still very over with the fans. He's a believable badass. Probably should have been champion a long time ago, but that's neither here nor there. I would put the belt on Joe. So the way I see things going, I'd have Joe go over Lashley. I would have, you know, it's tough. I would say King over Aries, just because you can't beat every member of MVP's faction on this show. One of them has to go over. And of the two, Lashley is probably the more likely to go over. You know, Lashley got a clean win over the champion in a non-title match on Impact on Thursday. So why they didn't just change this match when they realized MVP was hurt to a singles match between Eric Young and Bobby Lashley? I mean, that seems like that would have made more sense. Lashley is probably more likely to go into that main event and then maybe Aries over King. But again, I would do it where Joe advances just so we can get the belt on him. And put Kenny King in there. Let him get a win over Austin Aries just so he can get into the main event with Joe going over in the end. That's how I would do it. EC3 and Bully Ray in a Texas death match. I'm going to go with EC3 here. Bully Ray seems like he's been getting the best of him for a while. EC3 has, you know, recently he's bled. He lost that first blood match on TV. And the idea here should be to put over the newer guy. Bully Ray does not need to win this match. Bully Ray is an established guy. He's 40-something years old. He's been around forever. They've done a pretty good job of making EC3 into somebody in this company. Here's a guy that got cut by WWE, who was toiling on NXT, back when NXT was not what it is now. It was a comedy show almost on Sci-Fi, back when he was Derek Bateman, and they cut him loose, and he went to TNA, and to their credit, they've done something with him, and I think they've got something in him as the EC3 character. He needs to win this match a hell of a lot more than Bully Ray does. I think he needs a good showing. I'm sure he'll take some abuse. He'll probably bleed, but I think in the end, EC3 should go over here, so he's my pick. They've added a ladder match for the X Division Championship. Don't ask me why. No rhyme or reason. They just had a bunch of guys that they have no role for, and they said, hey, let's shove them in a ladder match. Why not? Manic is in this match. I couldn't even fucking tell you the last time Manic was on Impact. So he's in this match. Tigre Uno, Crazy Steve from the Menagerie, Sonata, who is the reigning X Division champion from Japan, Eddie Edwards and Davey Richards, the Wolves, the reigning tag team champions, are in here as well. And that will be an X Division title ladder match. Sonata is my pick to retain. Magnus will take on Willow one-on-one. Bram will be in Magnus's corner, and the Monster Abyss will be in Willow's corner. Magnus is my pick here. James Storm against Mr. Anderson. I'll go with James Storm. Just because I think if they, by chance, were to put the title on Samoa Joe, yeah, they've got guys like Lashley and Kenny King who are MVP's henchmen who he could defend against. But I think they need another really strong heel. I'd start building James Storm back up to a level of respectability here. And James Storm as a heel, feuding with Samoa Joe for the title, could be a program down the line. So I would go with James Storm here. Angelina Love against Gail Kim for the Knockouts title. Angelina Love is my pick to retain. The Von Erich family will be on the show. The Von Erich name is still a name that draws in Dallas. So they're going to be in action. And more specifically, Kevin Von Erich, I think it's his son's. So he'll be there. He'll be in his son's corner. Supposedly, when TNA announced that the Von Erichs would be on the card, it did help move some extra tickets. So, you know, why not? Why not throw them on the show as an attraction? Anything they can do to draw more people to the building is a plus. I have no idea who they're wrestling, but it doesn't matter. And they're also going to be announcing the third inductee into the TNA Hall of Fame. That person will be named by current Hall of Famer Kurt Angle. I'll go ahead and say Samoa Joe, especially with Angle being the one to make the announcement, the history that he and Joe have together. Would not surprise me if Samoa Joe was the guy to go in. I don't think it matters that he's still an active wrestler. So is Kurt Angle, right? And he went in. They turned it into an angle for Angle. It's always weird when I talk about angles that Kurt Angle is involved in. My second guess, if not Joe, would be Jeff Hardy. I could see them putting Jeff Hardy in the Hall of Fame. You know, Willow can keep wrestling, but they could put Jeff Hardy in the Hall of Fame. But Joe's my first choice. And that's your Slammiversary card. Not a pay-per-view I'd go out of my way to spend $50 on, or whatever ridiculous amount they charge for these shows these days. Impact on Thursday night. The story of this show was Eric Young had to beat two members of MVP's faction, which still has no name, by the way, in order to choose the stipulation for his and MVP's match at Slammiversary, a match that isn't even taking place now, which rendered all of this useless, such as the risk that you run when you tape television weeks in advance like they often do. Lashley beat the crap out of the champion in the first match. He pinned him clean. EY came back, beat Kenny King in match number two with a powerbomb. And don't tell me it was a pile driver, okay? I saw it. It ended up more like a powerbomb than a pile driver. If that was a pile driver, it was the worst pile driver I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, and I know they have to be safe, but if that's what constitutes a pile driver these days, then you know what? Just outlaw the damn move and don't even try it. So then in the main event, we had Eric Young beating MVP by disqualification. Not only did they give away their pay-per-view main event for free on TV for the second time, by the way, in recent weeks, they've done this match, but they defeated the whole purpose of this show, having Eric Young run the gauntlet by having MVP beat him within an inch of his life, and then instead of finishing him off, he goes outside, he grabs a chair, and he hits him with it, and he gets disqualified, which meant that EY got to pick the stip for their pay-per-view match. He chose Steel Cage, to which Mike Tenay said that it would keep out Bobby Lashley and Kenny King. WWE did the same shit with Cena and Bray Wyatt before Extreme Rules. It was stupid then, and it's stupid now. When was the last steel cage match that we saw in either company where somebody did not interfere in some way? I wish they would stop insulting our intelligence. I know it's a fat chance, I know, but I just wish they would. We had a segment where Willow came out to confront Bram and Magnus. Willow said that he would have the Monster Abyss in his corner at Slammiversary, which at least makes sense given the way that Magnus dumped Abyss as his bodyguard a while back. Willow did a typical Willow promo, which makes little sense. Actually made no sense to me at all. Not much to it beyond that. That's pretty much all that was. Nux beat Robbie E in a match where the less that's said, the better. They now play the Menagerie's music throughout the entire match when one of them wrestles. They did some comedy. Robbie is still afraid of clowns. Crazy Steve shoved some balloons into Robbie's ass crack, and he ran away thinking there was a clown chasing him. This sucked. Then we had a segment where EC3 and Rockstar Spud were in the ring, and they brought out Brooke Tessmacher, who has not been seen on television for a while. They brought out Brooke, and they were questioning her and talking about, you know, when you and Bully Ray were together, you know, back when Bully Ray was still in Aces and Eights mode. Yeah, they were asking her questions about, did he mess around with other women, and all of this stuff that she kept denying and saying, no, that's not true at all, that didn't happen, and this went on for a while, and eventually Bully came out, he chased them away, and he was very nice to Brooke. All of a sudden, I love how, you know, when he's heel Bully Ray, he will say the most heinous shit to a human being. I mean, the stuff that he said to Brooke was so awful. And here in this segment, because now he's got to be the babyface, he said, he basically apologized to Brooke. Okay, that's what he did. He apologized. He said that you're a wonderful woman, you were a great girlfriend, and she forgave him, and they hugged, and all was right with the world. I love it. I love it when guys turn, and it changes their whole character. EC3 then challenged Bully Ray to a tables match, so a little bit of role reversal there. He challenged Bully to a tables match and said that, you know, you're going to put my Aunt Dixie through a table over my dead body. And Bully became fixated on that phrase, and he kept repeating it over and over and over again. Over my dead body, over my dead body. And that led to Bully instead challenging EC3 at the pay-per-view to a Texas death match. Which, all I can say about that is at least it's something different than a tables match or whatever usual shit they would do. They're going to do a Texas death match in Texas, in Dallas. And I think it'll be a good match. Again, it'll be an important match for EC3, I think. And he probably should go over in that match. But he needs to go in there and have the performance of his life, I think, with Bully Ray. You know, he's in one of the featured matches on this pay-per-view. They've been building this up for a while. He needs to go in there and knock it out of the park. And we'll find out. We'll see if he does. Gail Kim beat Brittany and Madison Rayne in a three-way, pinning Brittany after eat defeat. Velvet Sky was outside with Angelina Love watching the match. And Velvet tried to spray Gail in the face with hairspray, but she ducked. Hit Brittany in the eyes with it instead. That led to the finish. So it'll be Gail and Angelina for the title on pay-per-view. And as I mentioned earlier, it was MVP and EY in the main event. We all know what happened there. Completely useless now that MVP is not wrestling on the pay-per-view. One interesting note here, I mentioned this on Twitter. I did a search when Impact ended. I didn't watch Impact until later on, but when the show went off the air, actually during the show, not just when it went off the air, I did a search for the Impact Live hashtag. Even when they do these tape shows, they still have the hashtag Impact Live, which is comical. I did a search for it. I wanted to see how much Twitter activity there really was for that hashtag. And no joke, 95% of the people using that hashtag were people under contract to TNA. One after the other. It was Jeremy Borash. It was Robbie E. It was Abyss. It was Magnus. It was all these wrestlers, all the people that are actually in TNA, who of course are sitting at home watching this because the show was taped, you know, 5 weeks ago. They're the ones tweeting about the show. Very few others. And I thought that was very telling and also very sad. Mailbag. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. That includes MP3 audio questions. If you would like to email those over as an attachment, try to keep them relatively brief. And always include your name and where you are from when you write in. The first thing here I want to share with you is not a question, but some feedback, keeping with the TNA theme here, from a longtime TNA diehard, John, from Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And I think this really illustrates the problem TNA finds itself in these days when it loses support from a guy like John. So I wanted to share this with you. He says, "I'm not someone who loves bashing TNA for the sake of it. I was a fan since the 2004 Fox Sports days when I found TNA by flipping through the channels and seeing my favorite wrestler, Jeff Hardy. I was ecstatic to see Jeff again, and although he left TNA late in 05, I stuck with the product because they were a legitimate alternative to WWE. I love the combination of the six-sided ring, the X Division, with guys like Petey Williams, Sanjay Dutt, Amazing Red, Sabin, Joe, AJ. Heavyweights like Monty Brown and Abyss, and concepts like King of the Mountain, Ultimate X, and Six Sides of Steel. I even enjoyed seeing guys like Raven Rhino and Jeff Jarrett experience career rebirths while they were there. That all combined to make a different product, and I was hooked. When they finally got their deal with Spike, I was so happy for them. Fast forward about a decade, and I am no longer happy. Honestly, I'm disgusted. It boggles my mind that the same company I saw back in 04-05 with limitless potential has devolved into whatever the hell airs on Thursday nights now. It boggles my mind that the co-founder of that company just said, screw it, and left to begin anew. It also boggles my mind that TNA felt they had to let guys like Styles, Daniel, Sabin, and Kaz go as a means of cutting costs due to their own financial incompetence, even though all of those guys proved that they deserve raises. This makes me wonder, why should I show respect or loyalty to a company that doesn't do the same for its hardworking performers? Keep in mind, when I say that, I'm not just referring to the people who have been recently cut. Take a look at cases like Daphne's, as you've mentioned here on your podcast, Jesse Sorensen, and even Conan's for further examples of how TNA talent is often treated. Why should I support that? At this point, I don't even know what's going to happen with TNA, and frankly, I'm finding it hard to care. Even the option of seeing Jeff Hardy in whatever incarnation is not enough for me to care about that company. If TNA dies, I'll hate it for the talent and some people behind the scenes because they'll have to replace that income somehow. However, I refuse to show this company any more loyalty or respect than they've shown to the people who have put their bodies on the line to see TNA succeed, only to turn around and get piss-poor compensation in return. All that considered, seeing and hearing that New York crowd chant "Fuck TNA" while AJ Styles grinned from ear to ear at the War of the Worlds show is tied with the "You Deserve It" chant for Daniel Bryan and the post-WrestleMania Raw as my favorite chant of the year. I find it very ironic that at one time, guys like AJ and Daniels leaving Ring of Honor for TNA was an upgrade, whereas now, it's an upgrade for them to leave TNA and go back to ROH. If for no other reason, it's an upgrade because I don't think there's much doubt about whether or not Ring of Honor will still be around next year, where there is a ton of doubt as to whether or not TNA will be around next year. So that comes from John. I wanted to read that whole thing here because I've heard from him and a few others who usually speak very highly of TNA, and again, they've been fans going back to the old Fox Sports days. You know, it's almost like that base WWE audience. Like, WWE, no matter how crappy their shows may get, they always have a certain base of fans that will watch their crap no matter what. They'll never get below a certain number. And TNA has its base, too. I mean, how else can you explain a million people watching that show every week? But here's an example of a guy who's part of that base that seems to be eroding. And people are saying, you know, listen, enough's enough. You know, everything that I'm saying, everything that other people are saying, I'm not bashing TNA just for the sake of it. There's a lot of validity to the things that are being said. And this is a longtime fan here who's giving up because he just doesn't like what he sees anymore. And that's a big problem for TNA. This week's audio question comes from Michael in Los Angeles.
Hey, Solid Monster. This is Michael from Los Angeles, California. My question is about the Intercontinental Championship. Back in the day when I was growing up, the Intercontinental Championship was looked at as that workhorse title. If that mentality still stood today, who could you see actually being that type of champion? I know for me it would be guys like Daniel Bryan, maybe somebody like Cesaro, and even CM Punk when he was still with the company. So I was wondering what you thought. Thank you.
Michael's right. The Intercontinental title back then was known as the workhorse title. You had guys like Savage, Steamboat, Hennig, Brett, Shawn, all those guys who could really go. And you go back into that mid to late 80s period, a guy like a Hulk Hogan was not a great worker. I mean, he was the top guy. People were buying tickets to see him, but you never expected Hogan to go in there and have a great match or a really, really long match. And even with house shows, I mean, there were house show loops where the Intercontinental title would be the featured main event. If Hogan was doing the A show somewhere, and the B show would be headlined, let's say, by Savage and Honky Tonk Man, or Savage and Steamboat, or, you know, maybe the Ultimate Warrior when he was the Intercontinental Champion. Now, the Ultimate Warrior, I guess, was kind of the exception there. I don't know that he was ever looked at as the workhorse, like some of the old IC champions were. But today, I think the people that you would see that would fit that role, I think of Dolph Ziggler because he reminds me a lot of Mr. Perfect back in the day, you know, bumping around as the heel IC champion. I could see Ziggler being that person. He's clearly a workhorse, so he would be in there. Any member of the Shield, more specifically Rollins or Ambrose, but probably Rollins. I could see Rollins as a workhorse Intercontinental champion. I think of the two champions we have now in the mid-card, Wade Barrett and Sheamus. You know, they're in the same category. Sheamus is a really good worker. You could say what you want to about him being boring and they never do anything with him, and that's all valid. I agree 100% on that. But he's a really good wrestler, especially when he's in there with somebody that could really go with him. Sheamus is really good, and he could be a workhorse IC champion. Barrett could fit that bill as well. So Cesaro, as you mentioned, Cesaro absolutely, I think, could fit that role. So those are the guys that I would see kind of in that mid-card, but the key is, a lot of those guys back then, and I know a guy like a Mr. Perfect never won the big one, Rick Rude never won the big one, but a lot of guys did. It was a launching pad for a guy like a Bret Hart and a Shawn Michaels to bigger and better things, and I'd like to see more of that, where they take a guy who they know one day is going to be a world champion, and they say, you know what, before we do that, let's put the Intercontinental title on him, let him get some rub from being the IC champ, and that eventually that will help kind of propel him to that next level. Somewhere along the way, that got lost. That's not the purpose anymore of the Intercontinental title. It's just a title to put on somebody so it has, you know, some sort of purpose. So it has something to do where they can get it on television, And that's it. They don't have any meaningful plans anymore for the guys who hold those mid-card titles. I don't believe that at all. Do I think that Bad News Barrett is the champion now because one day they think, okay, this guy is going to be the WWE champion? Hey, I hope he is. But is that why they put the IC title on? Of course not. Was that why Big E was the Intercontinental Champion? Of course not. And I don't see how anybody gets any sort of rub from wearing that belt at all anymore. So a lot has changed since then. But those are some of the names that I would put in that category. Graham Matthews wants to know, what if Stephanie McMahon brought in Karma to fight her battles for her against Brie Bella? I'm fully aware that Brie was just, quote, fired, but we all know she'll be back before long. WWE does not do long-term booking more often than not, but it can be traced back to Karma wanting to get revenge on the Bellas for bullying her before she left on maternity leave in 2011. I realize a Karma return is not in the cards right now, but it's more of a what-if scenario than anything. It would beat a Stephanie Brie match, that's for sure, and Karma could stick around and have great feuds and matches with Paige and AJ Lee. I don't hate this idea. I really don't. I think it's a good idea, and there's a natural tie-in with the Bellas, although the Bellas are faces now, and they were heels back then when they were bullying the poor woman when she was in WWE, so that might be weird. You know what I would prefer, though? You mentioned Karma, and it got me thinking. What I would prefer to do with Karma, if they wanted to bring her back, AJ Lee is coming back at some point. I don't know when. She just got married. Apparently, her and Punk got married on Friday night, so congrats to them. I don't know if they're going on a honeymoon or what their plans are. My guess is that AJ is going to be back probably towards the end of the summer, middle of the summer. She'll be back maybe in time for SummerSlam. I don't know. But she's coming back at some point. When AJ Lee is ready to return, since Tamina is out for a while, she just had knee surgery, so she's not going to be back anytime soon, I would bring back AJ with Karma as her new heavy in a feud with Paige for the Divas title. Last time we saw AJ, Paige embarrassed her on television. She beat her. She ended her reign, Paige's very first match, and she beat AJ. When AJ comes back, she should come back seeking revenge on Paige. And when she does, Karma can be her new bodyguard. And I love that dynamic, too, because AJ is so tiny. And Karma, I think she lost some weight, so Karma may not look quite as monstrous as she was when we last saw her. But she's still a big lady, a lot bigger than AJ. So I like that dynamic of AJ bringing in a woman who's so much bigger than her to fight her battles for her. And we get the feud that we didn't get before between AJ and Paige. And I think they could have some good matches. And during that, or when that wraps up, you can also do the natural matches between Paige and Karma. I don't know if Paige can have the kind of feud with Karma that Gail Kim did in TNA when they put that knockouts division on the map. Paige is really good. She has not yet been given the chance to show on Raw what she can do, what we saw her do on NXT when she was having matches that went longer than 10 minutes. She even had a couple of 15-minute matches with Emma. So I think bringing AJ back right into feud with Paige, it's a natural thing to do, and she's got Karma as her backup, and you can have matches with Paige and AJ and Paige and Karma. And I think that can carry the Divas division for several months. So I actually like that idea more. Brian writes in, I was watching some old WWF pay-per-views and almost forgot that Tony Schiavone had a short stint there. What was his reason for going to WWF before eventually going back to WCW? Money. Money, and I believe they had made Jim Ross the lead announcer in the NWA, and Tony was kind of relegated to the second string, which did not sit well with him. I'm not sure if he and JR hated each other, but that's basically what happened. He got an offer from WWF around that time. He moved his whole family to Connecticut, which is a very expensive place to live. I don't think he ever liked it over there. Well, what did JR call Connecticut all those years later when he had his little heel turn on TV? Called it an overpriced hellhole. So he went over to WWE, and he was the lead announcer on a couple of pay-per-views, a lot of their syndicated shows. This was in 89 into the early part of 1990. He may have only had a one-year deal. Then there were some political changes behind the scenes that happened in WCW. And I think JR got demoted or he had lost some power. Whatever happened, he was no longer the head announcer. He was on the outs. And that paved the way for Schiavone to negotiate a new deal for more money to go back to WCW. and to be their lead announcer. And it was more money than WWF was offering at the time, and he took his family and he went back to Atlanta. So that's what happened. Adam the Maniac Massaglia in Calumet, Michigan. I was watching the true story of WrestleMania, and when WrestleMania 3 came up, Basil DeVito, WWF's senior advisor for business strategy, said that a week before the event, they had sold out a total of 93,173 tickets. WWE has always claimed this number to be the physical attendance at the show. People in the know have said the actual attendance was between 70 and 80,000. Are the attendance numbers WWE announces at their show strictly ticket sales? I would imagine it would be easier to track how many tickets were sold than to count everybody that enters the arena. Where do you think these numbers come from? Well, the 93,173 number, I believe, is fiction. Okay, the actual attendance supposedly is closer to 80,000, maybe like around 78,000. Dave Meltzer has told this story 1,000 times, and people just don't want to hear it. You know, it's Meltzer. It's discredited automatically. Well, let's look at this, okay? Meltzer, for years, in the late 80s, into the early 90s, he reported the 93,000 number in his newsletter like everybody else did. And one day he had a conversation with a guy by the name of Zane Breslov. Zane Breslov was a promoter for WWF at the time. He helped promote WrestleMania 3 in Pontiac. He also promoted for Eric Bischoff many years later in WCW, and he died in a motorcycle wreck many, many years ago. So unfortunately, we can't go find Zane Breslov and ask him to give definitive word on this. But it came up in a conversation that Breslov and Meltzer had, and Breslov said, you do realize that the actual attendance for WrestleMania 3 was actually 78,000. And he faxed the document proving it over to Meltzer. Now, he doesn't have it anymore, but I think when he asked Vince McMahon about it afterwards, because Meltzer and Vince would have conversations quite often back in the day. I don't know when the last time was they actually spoke. There was a point where Vince got very big and WWE got very big and they cut off the wrestling media, but it was commonplace for him to have conversations with guys like Meltzer and Keller. Like, they actually would talk on the phone for hours at a time. So, as the story goes, Meltzer had contacted Vince, or they were having a conversation, and he asked him about it, and Vince did not deny it. He did not deny the fact that the 93,000 number may not have been legit. Instead, what he told Meltzer was that the numbers that we announce on TV for these shows are part of the entertainment. It happens to this very day. You know, whatever the attendance that they announced for WrestleMania, they always exaggerate it. They usually exaggerate it by 10 to 15,000. It was no different back then. They had a number in their head a long time before WrestleMania 3 even took place, figuring nobody would ever be able to top it. And then, unfortunately for them, they went and announced the number, and a few months later, that same year, the Pope came to the Silver Dome for Mass and broke the record. Or at least that's what the Pope and his people claimed. That was probably a fake number, too. My fake number beats your fake number, you know, that kind of thing. But it's all part of the entertainment, people. I'll take the word of a guy who actually promoted the event over the number that they announced on television. Pat in Minneapolis writes in, I'm a big Jack Swagger fan, maybe the only one, and on this week's Raw, it seems like they maybe are going to do something with him. My question is it too late? Do you believe WWE can rebuild guys to upper mid-card or main event status, or is there a point where a wrestler's career is just too damaged to do so? That's the question. It depends on the person. It really does depend on the person. Like, for example, a guy like a Dolph Ziggler. I think if they took their head out of their ass and got over whatever their issue is with the guy, and they actually pushed him, but they did it the right way. They did it smart. You know, they acknowledge that he's fallen on tough times, he's had some big losses recently, and he's been down to the dumps, but he's bound and determined to turn things around, and his goal is to one day be the world champion again. And all of a sudden, he went on a win streak, and they put him in bigger matches, and he actually won. And the thing with Dolph is, it's one thing to, let's say, put somebody on a win streak and put him on TV, but he has, like, average matches or crappy matches, and the fans just kind of, they can't get behind him. But Ziggler, if he goes out there and he has kick-ass matches and he's stealing the show, people will very easily get behind the guy. So I look at a guy like Dolph Ziggler and I say, it's not too late. if they want to change their ways and actually do something with him and elevate him back up to upper mid card or like what I would call low main event status, because he's never going to be at the level of a John Cena, and maybe not even at the level of what Daniel Bryan was before he lost the belt and got hurt and everything happened. But absolutely, I think they could still get him back up to that level. Now, a guy like a Swagger, that I think is going to be a little bit tougher. There's just something about him and the way that he's been pushed and deep pushed that I don't see him getting back up to that level that you're talking about. Damian Sandow, very difficult for me to see him get back up to that level. There may be some other guys I can give as examples. I'm not thinking. You know, Ziggler is the one who jumps out to me as the most egregious example of taking a guy who could really be something and he's not, and it's not necessarily his fault. I mean, without them, you know, telling people why exactly they're booking him this way, there's no way to know. Like I said, maybe he slept with somebody's wife. Who the hell knows? But a guy like Ziggler, no, it's not too late. Swagger probably is. Sandow is getting very close. This comes from Cliff. When did humor become such an important part of WWE's weekly shows like Raw? I know WWE has always tried to incorporate humor into their programming. For example, the Bobby Heenan show back in the day. But 20 years ago, it wasn't necessary for every wrestler to try to crack jokes during their promos or to have humorous skits between matches. I'm going to take a guess and say that when The Rock's humorous promos started to get over, WWE decided that everybody had to try to be funny. I don't know if it had anything to do with The Rock, but it goes back, I think, to the Attitude Era, that whole Monday Night Wars, Attitude Era period. And we've seen it ever since. Again, if you go back before that, you had comedy characters. It's not like we never had comedy on Raw. But like you said, it was selective. It depended on the character. One of my favorite periods, in all honesty, in WWE, if you go back just before the Attitude boom, was what I would call the beginning of the Attitude Era, even though a lot of people don't acknowledge it as part of the Attitude Era. And that was late 1996, 1997, WWE, when if there was comedy, it was very limited. When I think back to that time period, it was serious shit. Everybody was pissed off about something. Shawn Michaels was always pissed off. Steve Austin was always pissed. He was probably born pissed off. Undertaker, Sid, they had, you know, Brett constantly crowing about, I got screwed, you screwed me, I quit, and all this kind of stuff. And then he formed the Hart Foundation. I don't remember any of that stuff being played for comedy. I mean, everything revolved around the title. Everybody wanted to be the champion. He who has the title has the power. That was the edict back then, just based on the way they booked the stuff. And I liked that. I liked that when things were built around the championship because it made the title feel special. And these guys were going to go out there and they were going to do and say whatever the hell they had to do to get themselves over at everyone else's expense. And Shawn would go out there and rip on Brett. Brett would rip on Shawn. Sid would rip on all of them. Undertaker would rip on all of them. Steve Austin would rip on everybody equally. And they were just very pissed off and they went out there and they kicked ass. And that's what wrestling should be. And, you know, you're right. When The Rock was doing his stuff, but again, it wasn't just The Rock. There was a lot of comedy all of a sudden that came into the picture, and we never really got away from that. If anything, it's only gotten worse. At least the comedy back then was mostly funny. 90% of the comedy or more that we see now is not funny. Bo Dallas is great, but not everybody is a Bo Dallas. Not everybody knows how to play their character like he does or like Santino did at one time. I think he's just completely played out and stale now, but there was a period where Santino was awesome. Tea Time with Santino, that segment with Sheamus and Kozlov, they did that on Raw in the UK once. That was awesome. I love that segment. That's an example of comedy done right. But at some point, they thought, well, you know, everything has to be built around comedy, and they built one of their pay-per-view main events once at Survivor Series. It was a three-way match between John Cena, Triple H, and Shawn Michaels. It might have been back in 09. They built that whole freaking main event on comedy. And they expected it to sell. And that pay-per-view did so horrendously that Vince McMahon, for a while there, for a few months, axed the Survivor Series off the schedule. They were going to replace it with something else. For months on the pay-per-view listing, they had TBA to be announced. And at some point, they got Vince to change his mind, and they brought back Survivor Series. So we never really missed a show. But for a while there, they eliminated it. As though it was the Survivor Series' fault. You know, all of a sudden, Vince came to this wild realization after all these years maybe people just aren't into elimination matches anymore, and that's why they're not buying this pay-per-view, and that's why this one did so awful. So we'll just do away with it and come up with some meaningless B-show name for a pay-per-view. No, dude, it was because you based your whole main event on comedy. That was for the championship. I think Hornswoggle may have been involved there in some way, too. I don't remember, but you can't do that. You can't do that and be successful. Matt from Chicago, my question today stems from Vader's recent appearance on Steve Austin's podcast. When talking about WCW, Vader mentioned he had issues with Paul Orndorff. It sounds like they had heat, and it affected his time in WCW, but he didn't really go into detail. Can you please explain this? Why was there heat between Vader and Orndorff? What incident or incidents is Vader referring to? Well, it was a backstage fight that happened in WCW. It would have been in 95. It was right before Vader came over to WWE. There are a lot of different versions of this story, just so you know. Most of them are pretty much in agreement on one thing, and that is that Vader got his ass kicked by Orndorff. Vader's story is that Eric Bischoff had asked him to do a photo shoot that day. And this was just prior to a TV taping at Center Stage in Atlanta. They were taping a whole bunch of hours of TV worldwide and all that kind of stuff, and Vader had to be at the building and was going to be, but again, Bischoff called him and said, listen, Leon, I need you to do a photo shoot. And Vader, you know, I was concerned that I was going to be late, but Bischoff told me not to worry about it and said that Bischoff was going to let everybody know that Vader's going to be late. So he does the photo shoot, and he shows up late to the tapings. And Paul Orndorff was an agent that night, and he sees Vader, and he asks him, where the hell have you been? You're late. Vader said, listen, you're not my boss. And Orndorff may have called him a fat ass in response. Again, what the exact words were, you'll get different answers from different people. Vader claims that Bischoff, again, he promised him he was going to let everybody know he was coming in late, and obviously Bischoff never did that, or they never told Orndorff. And the whole thing, it sounds like it was a misunderstanding more than anything else. Everyone said that Vader sucker-punched Orndorff, and that's what started things rolling. Of course, Vader says otherwise. He says Orndorff was only a few inches from his face, and he was threatening him, and so he reacted. He also claims that he knew, Vader claims, he would end up in jail if he really unleashed on Orndorff. So that's why he held back, and he was covering up his face, and he really wasn't fighting back as Orndorff is raining blows down upon him. So Orndorff, somewhere in this, kicked Vader in the face or in the head a few times with his feet while wearing flip-flops, which did some damage. And I'm sure that was quite the scene of Paul Orndorff in his flip-flops kicking the shit out of Big Van Vader backstage. Orndorff, finally, he's ushered into another room by some other agents. And at this point, Vader claims, now I'm ready to fight. And he goes into the room where they took Orndorff, and he tells him as much. He says, I'll meet you in the parking lot for a fight. But the other agents were not going to allow that to happen. And so it ended there. And, you know, Orndorff had nerve damage in his arm, which was well known, but he was still a big, tough guy. You know, Orndorff didn't fuck around. So that's what happened. I believe that was the reason that Vader got fired from WCW, although Vader claims he wasn't fired. He says Bischoff told him, go take some time off, go clear your head, go work in Japan or something, and then you can, you know, we'll bring you back. But he ended up going to WWF. You know, he had just turned babyface that year, right before all this happened. He was supposed to be one of Hulk Hogan's partners in the War Games match that year, but obviously that never happened. This comes from Nissim. I was reading the SmackDown spoilers when I ran into a response about a certain wrestler being buried because of a single loss. I would like you to explain to people the idea of pushing someone and burying someone. It seems like people think if a wrestler loses one match to a legitimate rival, they are being buried. The IWC, a name that you and me both hate, seems to be full of people that simply misunderstand the wrestling business. Maybe Delusional Dixie should consult them as much as she does Vince Russo. I don't know, bro. I think you made a good point there without me having to chime in much. I'm in agreement with you. People use and abuse that word so much, and they don't have any concept of what it really means. And I have to catch myself when I use the word bury. I try to use it only when it really is appropriate to use it, because I don't want a whole bunch of people saying, well, see, Solomonster said this person buried this person, and this person got buried, and And then it kind of blows back on me, so I have to try to be responsible whenever I use that word. But is it overused and abused? You bet your ass it is. And people just don't understand, I think, oftentimes, the context when they use it. They just assume this person lost, so that means they're buried. You know, and that's just not the case. And finally, this comes from Ross. It's not a question, but I wanted to share it anyway. He says, I just finished listening to your show on your 30 favorite Raw moments. I really enjoyed it. I also listened to your King of the Ring show from last year and enjoyed that one too. I really enjoy listening to shows like yours about WWF wrestling from the 80s and 90s and WWF Attitude period. I always learn something I did not know about, which is great. Thank you for putting in all the work to make those shows great. Well, thank you, Ross. I really appreciate that. And I wanted to read that here because we always have new listeners, and they may not be aware that I did two special episodes of The Sound Off. Episode 228, which was a countdown of my 30 greatest Raw moments. That was in the build-up to Raw 1000 a couple of summers back. And episode 278, which was dedicated to the history of the King of the Ring tournament. Because if WWE is not going to do it the right way and celebrate what King of the Ring used to be, then I figured, damn it, I used to be a big King of the Ring mark. I'm going to do a show dedicated to the history of it. So that's what I did. And that includes many of the ones that never aired on television. Going back, you know, all the way, people may not realize that King of the Ring goes back all the way to 1985 as a house show gimmick. So if you've never heard those shows before, go back in the archives and check them out. I think you'll like them. We're down to the final two history segments here. Next week is the final one before we do away with This Week in Wrestling History. And This Week in History actually features two of my all-time favorite WWE pay-per-view events. For those with the network who want to go back and watch them when you're done listening to the show, pay attention. 21 years ago this week, on June 13, 1993, first King of the Ring pay-per-view airs from the Nutter Center, still one of the funniest names of an arena in history, in Dayton, Ohio. We just got done talking about King of the Ring a moment ago. I did a whole podcast about it, so I won't go too deep into detail here because you've probably already heard me wax on about this. But this was my favorite of the King of the Ring pay-per-views of all the tournaments and one of my favorite all-time WWE pay-per-views, period. I loved everything about this show. I loved a lot of the matches on the show. I was a big fan of the commentary on the show. It was Jim Ross, which was, I think, the final time before he got demoted to doing, I think he was doing radio WWF for a while with Gorilla Monsoon. And, you know, early in 94 is when he got hit by the Bell's palsy and then he got released. And they only brought him back when McMahon got indicted for the steroid stuff and they needed a guy to take over on Raw. So, you know, he debuted at WrestleMania 9, JR did, in the toga. And King of the Ring 93 was his chance to shine before they took him out of that lead role. And I'm not sure why they did, because he was even better here than he was at WrestleMania. He was awesome here. And it was Savage, and it was Bobby Heenan. And the fact that they did the entire King of the Ring tournament in one night, and they didn't do it in piecemeal, just the semifinals and finals, it was the whole thing. You know, they had qualifiers on TV building up to it. Bret Hart had to run the gauntlet. He beat Razor Ramon in the opening match. He beat Mr. Perfect in the semifinals. And he beat Bam Bam Bigelow in an excellent match to win the King of the Ring crown. That was when Jerry Lawler came out during the ceremony. He was insulted that he wasn't even in the tournament, and Bret Hart was an imposter to the throne. And he beat the crap out of Bret Hart and started a feud between them that went on for over 2 years. So there was that. There was the Intercontinental title match. I was actually a fan of that one. Shawn Michaels defending against Crush. I thought they had some good chemistry. And it was also Hulk Hogan's final televised match for WWE for 9 years. He defended the championship against Yokozuna since he didn't want to drop it to Bret, I guess, at SummerSlam. So he dropped it here to Yokozuna. They did the gimmick with the exploding camera at ringside that blinded Hogan because, you know, Hogan wasn't going to lose clean. And Yokozuna started his longest championship reign of the two that he had. There were some other matches on the show as well, but it really boils down to Bret Hart. This was the Bret Hart show. If you want to go back and look at Bret Hart in his prime, you want to go back and look at Bret Hart at his best. I know some people might say his heel stuff in 97. His heel stuff in 97 in some ways was his best stuff, but that, I think, is in terms of the character stuff and the promos. I was a much bigger fan of Bret Hart matches in the early part of the 90s, 92, 93, 94. I was a much bigger Bret Hart fan from an in-ring point of view. And 1993 Bret Hart here in this pay-per-view in this tournament was awesome. He had his finger stomped on in the opening match by Razor Ramon. Came back out later on. He had tape around the fingers. He was still selling the injury. I love the stuff they did in the semis with him and Mr. Perfect. I love that. And that, again, it goes to what I said last week when I did the what-if scenario where Ricky Steamboat lost the Intercontinental title 2 months after he won it because he wanted some time off to be with his wife who just had their baby boy. And so Honky Tonk Man went on to have that long reign. Well, what would have happened had that not have gone down that way? You know, what if? What if they actually would have, for example, at WrestleMania 4, have had Steamboat move on in the title tournament to wrestle Savage in a rematch from WrestleMania 3, a friendly rematch. Both were baby faces at the time. And Savage got his win back and got a nice endorsement from Steamboat, and he went on to win the title. I mean, how awesome would that have been? They had a chance to give people the rematch that I'm sure they wanted to see, and they didn't do it. Well, here, they gave people a rematch of the Bret Hart-Mr. Perfect match from SummerSlam 91, which is an excellent match. I happen to like the Bret Hart-Mr. Perfect match at this King of the Ring show better than the SummerSlam match. You know, and the big difference this time, besides it being in a tournament, both were babyfaces, although Perfect acted very heelish during this match, but they had an awesome frickin' match. And Bret came back out and had another awesome match in the main event with Bam Bam. So he was awesome. It was totally the Bret Hart show. And still to this day, one of my favorite pay-per-views of all time. 20 years ago this week on June 9th, 1994, WWE held its first ever Hall of Fame induction ceremony in Baltimore, Maryland. Andre the Giant was the first inductee the year before, but this was the first actual ceremony that they held. Fred Blassie was inducted by Shane McMahon. Gorilla Monsoon was inducted by Jim Ross. Bobo Brazil was put in by Big Cat Ernie Ladd. Arnold Skolin, inducted by Bob Backlund, the man he threw the towel in on to give the title to the Iron Sheik. Skolin was Backlund's manager, so that was his role. That's the connection between the two of them. This ceremony was only a month or two before Backlund snapped and went all nutsy cuckoo on TV. Chief J. Strongbow was inducted by Tatanka. Buddy Rogers was inducted by Bret the Hitman Hart. And James Dudley, one of the most polarizing inductees in the Hall of Fame, was put in by Vince McMahon himself. Dudley, no relation to Big Dick, Bubba, Devon, or Dances with Dudley, just for the record, is known for being Vince McMahon Sr.'s limo driver. And he gets held up, even by myself at times here on this show, as being unworthy of the Hall of Fame. But from my end, a lot of that has to do with the fact that there are plenty of worthy people who still have not gotten their just due. Really, though, the Hall of Fame is a figment of a madman's imagination, so there's no reason to get too bent out of shape about any of this. But in the interest of being fair, I thought, let's take a look at James Dudley's career, because a lot of people listening to this have maybe heard the name, but they don't really know anything about the guy. They have no idea who he is, what his role was. He was more than just Vince Sr.'s limo driver, so I figured let's take a look at his body of work here. He was actually a hell of an athlete when he was younger. He could run a 100-yard dash in under 10 seconds, and he was a baseball player in the old Negro Leagues back in the day. He didn't play for very long, but he did play. After that, he started working for Jess McMahon, which is Vince McMahon, the current Vince McMahon's grandfather. And then finally, he ended up working for Vince Sr., where at one point, he managed an arena for Vince McMahon Sr. in Washington, which was a big deal, because that was the first time that any black person had been given such a major responsibility, you know, managing their own arena anywhere in the country. So right before he died, Vince Sr. told his son, whatever you do, you take care of James Dudley. And he did. He put him back on the company payroll long after he'd already been taken off of it. He bought him nice gifts over the years, and he put him in the Hall of Fame and did the induction himself. Vince McMahon has only done Hall of Fame inductions, I think, for James Dudley and for Steve Austin, unless I'm missing somebody. So you realize, while he may have played an important role for the company, so did a lot of other people over the years, and many of them are not in the Hall of Fame, and they may never be in the Hall of Fame. Jack Tunney was a figurehead president for the company on TV, but he actually promoted shows for WWF up in Canada. What about all the production people who played such an important role in the company over the years? What about Jimmy Miranda, the guy who Ultimate Warrior mentioned during his Hall of Fame speech? Should James Dudley be in the Hall of Fame before all of them? Of course not. But Vince Sr. told his son to make sure to take care of him, and that's what he did. 14 years ago this week, on June 11, 2000, WCW held its Great American Bash pay-per-view in Baltimore. Featured the ill-advised heel turn for Bill Goldberg, which did not last long because it was a stupid idea to begin with. He came out during the main event between Jeff Jarrett and Kevin Nash and speared Nash to help Jarrett retain the title, then hugged Eric Bischoff and Vince Russo. Also on this show, Hulk Hogan beat Billy Kidman in a match where if Hogan lost, he'd have to retire. And Ric Flair beat his son David in a match where, can you guess the stipulation? If Ric Flair lost, he would have to retire. Can't imagine why people were abandoning this company in droves that year. By the way, Russo was interfering like crazy in the Flair match. He was all over these shows at that time. And he thinks it was WWE's loss in 2002 when they decided not to bring him back as head writer. I would love to know how he figures that when he went on to have so many years at TNA and they went nowhere. But somehow, he would have turned around WWE's fortunes. If they just brought him back, they could be back at the height of their prosperity again. It's almost like the 8 years or however many years he spent at TNA, it's almost like it didn't happen. We can just forget that ever happened. All he needs to do is just go back home and things will go back to the way they were. That is the definition of delusional. 12 years ago this week, on June 10th, 2002, Stone Cold Steve Austin walked out of a Monday Night Raw taping in Atlanta. He did not clear it with anybody. He did not let anybody know before he left. He and Deborah left the building and flew back home to Texas because he was very unhappy with the creative plans for him that night, which called for him to not only wrestle Brock Lesnar, who was the next, they called him the next big thing, and he really was. They were going to have a match on Raw with no build-up, no promotion, nothing. Just have a match on Raw, Steve Austin against Brock Lesnar. And Lesnar was going to beat him. He was going to go over on him. I think it was going to be a King of the Ring qualifier. And Lesnar, of course, would go on to win the entire tournament anyway. But Austin thought it was stupid. And it was. It really was stupid. And he was on the phone with Vince trying to convince, you know, this is a bad idea, I'm not going to do it. And Vince was like, no, you're doing it. And that's why Austin just felt like, okay, I'm just going to leave. Because Vince had his mind set and he wasn't changing it. And it was a stupid thing for him to do. He even admits it. The biggest regret of his career, he said on his own podcast, was walking out the way he did. Mostly because he cost himself a shitload of money. Probably millions of dollars. Because they were able to withhold royalties and stuff because he walked out on the job. You're not going to get paid. So to this day, he says that was the biggest regret that he had. He could have handled it differently. He doesn't, you know, regret that he thought it was a crappy idea creatively. He still thinks it was garbage, and I agree. You know, why would you waste the first Steve Austin Brock Lesnar match on a King of the Ring qualifier on Raw without even building it up? Why would you do that match on Raw at all? That's a pay-per-view main event. So what happened was it forced them to change their plans. They had to scramble for a new main event. And they ended up changing all of their creative plans. Ric Flair at the time was the co-owner of Raw. He was a heel. He was in a feud with Austin. I think they were building to an Austin versus Flair match at the King of the Ring. All of a sudden, it was going to be Vince McMahon against Ric Flair with control of Raw, control of Raw, on the line. Flair, it was almost like Flair automatically reverted back to babyface mode. And Vince beat him and took full control back. And Flair was left without any power at all. And I think the match that they replaced Flair and Austin with it, the King of the Ring was Flair against Eddie Guerrero. So it caused a major shift in their creative plans because Flair was this heel co-owner, and all of a sudden he went from being a heel co-owner to a babyface again with no power at all whatsoever. And that was Austin's fault, although I'm sure he didn't intend for that to happen. But that was 12 years ago this week. 9 years ago this week, on June 12th, 2005, I mentioned at the beginning here that this week's history segment included two of my favorite all-time WWE pay-per-view shows. King of the Ring 93 was one of them. This was the other one. It was the first ever ECW one-night stand pay-per-view at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. My biggest regret living here in New York City was that I didn't go to this show. Because, and Webmaster Mike went to this show, and I curse him for doing so because I'm so jealous. It just seems like that would have been one of the most fun experiences to be part of was being in the building for that show that night. I love the show, and I was never a big ECW fan when ECW was around. I was aware of it. I would check it out, but it wasn't my thing. So I was never a big ECW fan. Yeah, I became a bigger fan of it later on with the Rise and Fall DVD and when I got to watch some of the great matches that were there. But even to this day, I would never consider myself like a big ECW fan like some people are. And yet I watched this show, which had the ECW fingerprints all over it. Paul Heyman clearly was running the show that night. All the old ECW faces were there, and the music, and the Sandman doing his thing, and everything else. And I at least was aware of who everybody was, and I enjoyed the hell out of this show. I had more fun watching this show, fun, pure fun, than probably any pay-per-view that they've ever put on before. And technically, it was a WWE show, but it was an ECW event. So whatever they did here, they needed to incorporate elements of this into their other shows, and it's too bad they never did. And it's too bad they got scared out of doing more shows from the Hammerstein after that one ECW TV taping where Batista and Big Show got booed out of the building and people were chanting change the channel and stuff, and they got so scared that they never went back. And I think that's a big mistake, because it's just a really fun atmosphere. And you want to have fun when you watch wrestling. This was a fun show. Rob Van Dam says that it was his idea. He pitched it to Vince and he ran with it. And that sucks for Rob because he was hurt. So he couldn't even wrestle on this show. He came out. His leg was in a brace, I think. He had just had knee surgery. He did some little angle. He was out there with Bill Alfonso, but he couldn't actually wrestle. But they had some great matches on this show. It opened with a Lance Storm Chris Jericho match that was really good. I remember there being a Chris Benoit, I think the Chris Benoit Eddie Guerrero match was on this show. I guess it would have had to have been because Eddie died a few months later. It was good, but I remember being somewhat disappointed. Those guys were past their prime at that point. Both were so beat up. Eddie was so beat up. And as we would find out later on, you know, always in just constant pain. And they couldn't quite do what they used to, but they did their best. I think what stole the show, quite frankly, was the Mike Awesome Masato Tanaka match. Those guys beat the piss out of each other. Chair shots to the head. I mean, if I go back and watch that match now, which I did recently, it's very uncomfortable to watch all the shots to the head, unprotected chair shots to the head, one after the other after the other. How Masato Tanaka is still performing, and performing at a high level over in Japan is mind-boggling to me, but he is. But it was really a breakout performance in a lot of ways for Mike Awesome. There was a lot of, you know, bad memories about how Mike Awesome left ECW. Joey Styles buried him, just absolutely buried him, to go back to that word, on commentary. You want to see a burial job on commentary, you got to listen to Joey Styles here. And I don't know how much of that was in character or not. I think a lot of it was personal, and I don't know how Joey would feel about it now, given what ended up happening to Mike Awesome, because I think at one point on commentary, he actually said that he wished he was dead. But the match was awesome as a spectacle, not so much as a wrestling match. These guys just beat the hell out of each other. They put each other through tables and chair shots, and I know Awesome blew his knee out at the end of the match, but he was the star of the show. Both these guys were. And the main event was the Dudleys against the Sandman and Tommy Dreamer. Sandman got to do his full entrance. He came out to Enter Sandman by Metallica, at least in the original version. They didn't dub it. It was awesome. It added so much to the show, seeing him do his thing to the original music. They had a match that ended with a flaming table spot, putting Dreamer through the table. Match was over. Steve Austin came out. The theme of the show was there were a group of WWE invaders led by Eric Bischoff that were up in one of the balconies. So Edge was there, and a lot of the jobbers, but like low-level guys, Maven and Rob Conway, and people were up there. And there was a Paul Heyman promo in the middle of the show where he came out, he started shooting on people, he looked up at the balcony, he shot on Bischoff, and Bischoff flipped him off. Heyman had a great botched line to Edge, who had just gone through the whole fiasco with Lita and Matt Hardy and all that kind of stuff. And Heyman goes, I got two words for you, Matt freaking Hardy. And Edge is just like, that's three words. You lied. That's three words. And then he turned his venom to JBL, who was mocking ECW on television for weeks, and Paul Heyman, and bounced checks and all that kind of stuff. And Heyman just goes, John, do you know why you were WWE champion for a year? The only reason is because Triple H didn't want to work Tuesdays. And I thought to this day, that was one of the all-time best lines ever, ever in a pro wrestling promo. I thought that was so awesome. So everything about this show was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. And it was enough of a success that 1 year later, they brought it back. They did a second ECW one-night stand show at the Hammerstein. Featured a great tag match that pit Edge and Mick Foley, who turned heel for the angle, against Tommy Dreamer and Terry Funk. Lita and Beulah got involved. I think Edge actually pinned Beulah in a very suggestive position to win the match. Edge came back later in the night dressed in riot gear as a security guard to cost John Cena the WWE title against Rob Van Dam. And boy, you talk about an atmosphere for a match. You talk about a guy being thrown into the lion's den. That was John Cena on the show, who was hated even then. So for people who think the Cena hate only came in the last 3, 4, 5 years, you got to go back all the way to 2006, because that's when it started. I think I've said before, I think it started at the end of the summer of 05. So the same year that Cena moved to Raw and won the title, it was only a few months later that the Cena hate started. It came, and I noticed it in the SummerSlam match that year with Chris Jericho. They had the dueling chants. That's when it started. You can trace it back to the end of the summer of 05. But he came in here, he wouldn't even look up. He held the belt up, he looked down at the ground. People were cursing him, flipping him off. It was a fuck John Cena chant. They threw toilet paper at him before the match. The best part was him throwing his shirt into the crowd. They kept throwing it back at him. And they had a really good match, too. I thought Cena and Van Dam had a really good match, and Van Dam beat him for the title. That easily was Rob Van Dam's crowning moment in his WWE career, to win the WWE Championship, beating John Cena on an ECW-themed pay-per-view. Easily the highlight of his career, has to be, in that company. 2 days later, WWE officially relaunched the ECW brand with a show on the Sci-Fi Network that saw the legendary debut of The Zombie. This was part of Sci-Fi's edict that they wanted sci-fi-esque characters on the show. I assume that's how we ended up with Kevin Thorne, the vampire, later on. I interviewed The Zombie right here on The Sound Off. That was my very first interview, episode 129. So I encourage you to go back in the archives and check that one out. This show also saw the debut of Kelly the Exhibitionist, better known as Kelly Kelly, who did a strip tease for everybody. This was 2 years before they went PG, so they can get away with that sort of thing. 5 years ago this week, on June 13th, 2009, Japanese legend Mitsuharu Misawa died in the ring a few days shy of his 47th birthday. He was teaming with Goshi Ozaki against Bison Smith and Akitoshi Saito for the NOAH promotion, the very same promotion that he helped build. Saito gave him a back suplex, and Misawa never got up. It's a very eerie scene when you watch it on YouTube. All the wrestlers are in the ring, surrounding the ring. They're just watching. They're hoping that he'll show some signs of life while the paramedics perform CPR, and they're pumping down on his chest. And when you see that, you know that it's a bad situation, and the crowd goes silent. It's just very sad to watch. It is on YouTube if you wanted to see. You know, they don't show you the actual suplex. The footage on YouTube starts immediately after the suplex, when he's just laying there, and the referee realizes something's wrong and the match stops. I don't know that a cause of death has ever officially been released, publicly at least. I know the police report speculated that it was a spinal cord injury that then resulted in cardiac arrest, but we don't know for sure. Misawa's matches with Toshiaki Kawada, Kenta Kobashi, those matches are as brutal as they are legendary in wrestling. Seriously, find some of those matches with Kobashi, and I'll never forget seeing one of them. I don't know if it was Misawa or Kobashi. I think it was Misawa. Delivered a German suplex to Kobashi off the ramp. Okay, that goes to the ring. So they're right by the ring, but it's an elevated platform. And they're right on the edge, and he gives them a freaking German suplex off the ramp, right onto the concrete floor. There's no padding, there's no nothing. Those guys in Japan, I mean, they absolutely destroyed their bodies doing that strong style stuff. I had the chance to see Misawa perform live at a Ring of Honor show back in 2007 in a match against Kenta. who may be WWE bound very soon. And 4 years ago this week on June 11th, 2010, Daniel Bryan was released by WWE, stemming from the big Nexus debut angle on Raw where they invaded and they beat up John Cena. And unfortunately for Bryan, he was caught on camera choking Justin Roberts with his own necktie, which violated the company's PG policy of absolutely no choking. Unless, of course, you're doing a choke slam. I guess that's different. He went back to working independence for a while until WWE realized they fucked up, and they brought him back 2 months later as a surprise member of Team Cena against the Nexus at SummerSlam. And the rest, as they say, is history. You might even say wrestling history. We got one more segment left to go next Sunday. I'm very sad it's coming to an end, as I know many of you are. And I still have not decided what, if anything, I'm going to replace it with. It's possible that it won't be replaced, and I'll just take a few more weeks to think about what I want to do, and maybe we'll just extend the mailbag a little bit. But yeah, it was a year ago next week, I think, or the week after that I started this segment, and I'm not going to start repeating myself. So we will cap off the history segment next Sunday on episode 333. In the meantime, you can email me questions for the mailbag at thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle. We're on Facebook as well. I have a profile page. My name on there is The Solomonster. That's two E's. It's a long story. I don't want to get into it. We have a Facebook group that you can apply to for membership and a page that I would be so appreciative of if you can like that page. I know it does not get as much attention as the group page does, but you can find that as well. And I want to give a big thank you to TV Tracks, which I don't do often enough, but TV Tracks is a very popular channel on YouTube, and he has featured the Sound Off prominently on his channel now for a number of years, and I know for a fact, because of that exposure, we've picked up a whole ton of new listeners. I mean, I did a Sound Off survey over a year ago and asked you guys, you know, how did you first hear about the Sound Off? How did you discover it? And I knew then a whole bunch of you. Put TV Tracks. That's how you guys first listened to the show through clips, and now you listen to the full podcast. So a big ups to him. I really appreciate it. You can check out his channel. He's got some other great content on there as well. If you like what you hear, this was a big show this week, well over, 2 hours and 20 minutes. I didn't mean to go that long, but if you like what you hear, by all means, there's multiple ways to support the show. Obviously, you can keep listening. That's the easiest and best way to support the Sound Off, is to keep listening and spread the word. But you can also donate via PayPal, whatever you feel is appropriate. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname if that matters to you. But you can always donate on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the little box on the right-hand side. You can give what you can. And you can sign up for a free Audible trial. Audibletrial.com/solomonster is our URL. If you go through that link and sign up that way, you get a free 30 days of the Audible service. You get one free audio book that you get to keep no matter what. You are under no obligation. You will only be charged beyond the 30 days if you continue with the service, if you like it that much. And if not, again, no harm, no foul. But just by signing up for a trial, you are helping out this podcast. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. And that about wraps it up. We will be back next weekend, the final history segment and a whole lot more. That'll be episode 333. So until next time, be well, stay safe, and we will see you right back here next time. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Solid into the cover, I can tell you. Solid's the NXT Women's Champion.
The bad.
We officially strip Daniel Bryan of the WWE World Heavyweight Championship.
It's a good night to be right.
And the ugly.
I made the mistake of reading Vince Russo's blog. He talks about how it's not creative. No, it's the crowds that are dead, and it's all theme park visitors who come inside because it's too hot outside. 900 people did not wander into the fucking impact zone because grandma was about to keel over from heat stroke.
Well, mostly the good.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007. On thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monster Sound Off.